And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whatever the case may be on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition, live from the land of enchantment, New Mexico, Indian country, or should I say Native Americans? Because they were certainly here long before we were. We have one hell of a show for you tonight because we've got the goods. And we've got the people to explain it to you, including a very vast faculty of consultants and guests and members of the Enterprise Mission Imaging Team and some kibitzers. Let's see, who's the kibitzer? We'll get through that when we get through. I want to hit a couple of high spots in the news first. For those of you who are new to the show, I want to tell you how to get to where you can see these images. We have this section called Radio with Pictures, where instead of showing stupid videos of, you know, people talking like, YouTube is so filled with nonsense, idiocy, talk about noise. What we try to do is provide imagery that we talk about, but you don't get to see us, thank God. You get to see the imagery and to focus solely on what we're describing in these astonishing history-making pictures. So what you want to do is go to theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our URL. That's our homepage. Click on that. That will take you to a very graciously laid out page, courtesy of Kintia, who is our art director for both Enterprise and The Other Side of Midnight and other things that we ask her to do from time to time in the artistic vein. And you click on tonight's banner, which says Artemis 1, Visit to a Planet Made of Glass. And then my friend Arthur in his incredible quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Click on that banner. That will take you to the guest page. And then right under there where it says in big yellow letters to listen to the show, it says in smaller letters in white, fast links to items, and you'll see my name, Ron Gerbron, Andrew Curry, Jonathan Womack, Robert Morningstar, and I think we're going to have Barbara adding something, but I may be wrong about that. Okay. Barbara is in the next line, which is all the bios. So when I talk about somebody, I'm not going to spend 20 minutes doing their bios because everybody has a bio that really deserves like 20 minutes. So you can go and read the bio if you're new to these people, to the site, to the investigation, to what we're doing tonight. In the meantime, I will give you a couple line shorthand, which will give the context of why these people are presenting to you tonight something really historic and incredibly important. So without further ado, click on my name, where it says Richard there, just click on that. That will take you to my section of the Radio with Pictures page. You can see the old RKO emblem there at the top that I freely stole and then modified because we actually had a development deal with RKO. Oh, the things that never were, but might be again, who knows? Life is short and history is moving at warp 9. Anyway, item number one. After 26 days in space, in deep space, which can include something like 270,000 miles, give or take, beyond the distance of the moon. That's total distance, 50,000 miles beyond the moon. The Orion spacecraft splashed down this afternoon Eastern time, morning Pacific, a few hundred miles off Baja, because there is a major cold front sweeping and a huge storm, winter storm, first of the season, sweeping down across the North Pacific. It's made landfall in California. The temperatures here today were almost 60. Tomorrow they're going to be like 30 degrees colder. And they're telling us we're going to have snow. Jingle bells, jingle bells. Anyway, item number one, this is the Artemis blog from NASA, which has been a mainstay of this page for months and months and months since I think last August when they were first trying to launch this thing. Well, they did it, they did it, they did it, and we will in the ensuing days hear from NASA and, of course, with our commentary, all the play-by-play of how amazingly successful this spacecraft was. The launch vehicle, well, that's something else, and we're not going to take a lot of time tonight, but you cannot develop a sustainable program to go back to the moon and put a colony in the South Pole and do all the things that we're going to need to do in the next few years when the mainstream suddenly realizes what you're going to get a first row seat tonight and looking at, which is the moon is studded with incredible ancient artificial ET artifacts all over the damn place, particularly at the South Pole, hiding under an extraordinary planet-wide, I use the term planet loosely for the moon because it is basically a planet-sized object, planet-wide glass dome, which is highly concentrated at the South Pole. In other words, more of it is left there than around the equator, certainly on the side of the moon that we can see, the so-called near side. And that's where NASA plans to put a base, a developing city on the moon to be permanently occupied in the out years, just like the International Space Station has been continuously occupied since, will you believe it, 1998. I remember it well. Anyway, but you're not going to do that with a Congress which is on the best of days kind of iffy about space. I mean, they like showing up for golden shovel moments or taking credit for some astonishing economic breakthrough in terms of spin-off technologies. But funding a real space program, NASA has not had a real budget. Apropos, when you account for inflation of what it was spending in the 1960s, when we sent Apollo to the moon first, it hadn't had a real budget for decades. I mean, it's now less than half of 1% of the federal budget. It's less than $19.5 billion per year. Heck, most other government agencies spend twice or three times that much, and some of them, the Pentagon, spends almost $1 trillion per year of the U.S. taxpayers' dollars. So NASA has been starved for money, starved for money, starved for money, and in that situation, it really is astonishing that we have sent this first unmanned, very expensive Artemis mission, this first of the Artemis program, following in the heels of Apollo after only 50 years, half a century. It's not that we didn't know how to do this stuff. All the conspiracy theorists say, oh, we never went to the moon. This is why it's taken so long to go back. No, it's all about money. Greenbacks, you know, the old cliche, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. We have starved NASA, and I think it's been part of the deliberate plan. Because you can't have NASA out there doing what it should be doing in a big, high, wide, and handsome way without them tripping over in ways that cannot be concealed any longer all the extraordinary ET stuff that's waiting for us that is going to transform irrevocably and for the better all of terrestrial civilization. You can't do that. So in the Hoagland geopolitical model of why NASA has been starved for money, we've been kind of eking out one little space station, dinky space station, although it kind of got its perks, you know, but it's really not going and exploring and embracing the solar system like we envisioned back when I was with Cronkite and a consultant to NASA. We've been kind of mucking along because they've held us in the shallow water, because in the deep water beyond the moon lie all the things they have not wanted us to know until, a caveat, until maybe now. Because NASA's plan in 2 or 3 years, again, star for money, is to send the first men and women back to the moon following Apollo, and then in short order, like a year or two after that, begin establishing this moon base, this first city in the modern era on the moon at the South Pole, and I don't mean right at the pole, but somewhere close by. And that's all going to take a lot of people, a lot of technology, a lot of hardware, a lot of money, and here's the bottom line. This Artemis 1 mission with the first test launch of both the booster, the Space Launch System, the follow-on to the Saturn V, which was kind of kludged together from hand-me-down parts and engineering from the Space Shuttle program, per a political influence on the name of Richard Shelby, Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama, who insisted that all of this be done in his state, with his taxpayers getting returns from the federal dollar back in his, you know, gravy train, and that it used this technology developed in Alabama at the Marshall Space Flight Center, which, of course, all took place, and that's why it now is overpriced. I mean, when you compare the cost of the Artemis system with the SLS, the Space Launch System, the big rocket with the two solid fuel boosters on the side of the orange tanks, that launched the other night on the 16th of November. That cost $4.1 billion with a B, billion. Hell, the B-2 bomber or the B-21 bomber, whatever, they only cost like half a bill for a reusable spacecraft or you know, they're almost spacecraft. Bombers, aircraft, you don't ditch them in the Pacific Ocean after one flight. This is what we did with the Artemis launch system. They ditched it in the Atlantic Ocean. It can never be used again. Now, contrast that with a guy named Elon Musk, who is developing an extraordinary separate system called the Starship Heavy Launch System in Texas, with launches also to take place on launch pad 39A at some point, thereby hangs the tail. He can send in the Starship, because of the technology he has developed and his engineers and his incredibly innovative team, for the price of $10 million to the moon, not $4 billion, 8 people, to do what Artemis 1 did in the last few days. 10 million versus 4 billion. So obviously, 4 billion is not sustainable. So obviously, the Space Launch System will use it maybe two or three more times. It will quietly be retired. Musk, who has the contract through SpaceX to develop the lunar lander part of the Artemis program, quietly is going to take over everything, except maybe for the spacecraft itself. It turns out you can actually launch the Artemis Orion spacecraft and its European service module on a Falcon Heavy for about 10 mil. And it can get to the moon, including its upper stage, for about 10 mil compared to 4 billion. Anyway, sorry to bore you with all these numbers, but if we're really looking at a sustainable program to go back to the moon, to land, to begin building a moon city at the South Pole where there are ample resources, we now know from unmanned missions over previous years, things like water, oxygen, nitrogen, carbohydrates, carbons, metals, everything to build an infrastructure, industrial level infrastructure from the lunar resources themselves. That's how it's going to have to be done. So just watch, you know, you've heard it here first probably. There will be a very elegant and smooth transition between the big NASA system that is so overpriced because of Shelby that there's no way it's part of a sustainable program, and what Musk has been quietly doing with NASA help, with NASA funding, but he has sure made the dollars go an incredible long way. And one of the ways that he is going to keep the cost down is something that NASA has been talking about for decades and never got around to actually implementing, which is you launch gas stations into orbit, and then you launch rockets into orbit, and after they expend their fuel going from Earth's surface to Earth orbit, they refuel in orbit. You top off the tanks, and then, as Robert Heinlein said, once you're in Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. All you need is the gas. So Musk has been designing his system to refuel starships, literally in low Earth orbit, and then he's going to send some to the moon and some to Mars and some. In other words, this is the way you develop a chemical rocket-based infrastructure that ultimately can, in the words of my dear departed friend Kraft Ericke, inherit the solar system. And I will add again, as you will see tonight. Okay, I spent a lot of time on number one. Number two, last night in the pre-dawn hours, as I said on last night's show, SpaceX successfully launched the Japanese lander, which has a NASA CubeSat, which is going to look for water at the South Pole with more resolution. It's got a UAE rover, and it's the first commercial mission, unmanned mission, that in 4 months, April, I think right around my birthday, they're going to land, God willing, and the creek don't rise, as my grandmother would have said. She was a big Tennessee Ernie Ford fan. Anyway, they're going to land on the moon, and I believe they're aiming for the South Polar region, which leads me to items 3 and 4. And this is where things are going to get really interesting tonight as we get into our discussion after we lay out some data. And I want everybody in the audience to pay specific attention to items 3 and 4. As I said in my tease for tonight's show, that we have a new secret weapon to make sure that everything we have found, in fact, is going to be made public and in a relatively close horizon timeframe. Are we waiting for NASA? I mean, NASA, because again, they're being starved for money, is not going to be able to put together the resources for Artemis II until 2 years from tonight. Come on. Is that any way to run a railroad, let alone a space program? In the meantime, a guy named Musk, who's developing the super heavy booster in Texas and the Starship to go with it, he is waiting for some, I think, FAA clearances, if I'm not mistaken, to have his first low orbit test flight in low Earth orbit of the Starship booster combination. And let's say that takes a couple. We know that Musk crew moves at an incredibly faster rate than the NASA crew. Well, when your launch only costs you $10 million instead of, $4 billion, yes, you can move faster. So he's doing all these very cool technological things, and he is saying now that within a year from tonight, there could be 8 astronauts, civilians, artists flying in the Starship around the moon in what's called the Dear Moon Flight. And everything you wanted to know about it is in items 3 and 4, including the fact that item 9, number 4, the Daily Mail, has done a very interesting profile on this ecologist and rather eco-freak fanatic, as they call her, anti-fracker and fossil fuel critic. I mean, everything negative they could say about this person, who is a professional photographer from Britain, who won one of the 8 seats. I mean, what did you have to do to win a seat on the first mission around the moon with a private unmanned or human-capable spacecraft? You basically had to send them an email and say, I want to go. Then they looked at you, and they did a background, and they did a I'm not quite sure how they selected the 8 people, because I haven't had time to really do much reading of those 2 links myself. But there are all those people listed, and there's deep background on all of them. And toward the end of the show, I will tell you, dear Other Side of Midnight audience, how you can help, beginning tonight, to play a pivotal part in opening up the solar system for us and everybody else. So stay tuned for that, okay? Item number 5. This is the Artemis overall flight plan graphic. We'll refer to it a couple of times during the evening. That's just kind of for background. Item number 6, this is a news story that comes out of the CBC. Isn't it interesting that within a couple of hours, the end of the Orion mission marked, certainly on the same day, and within a couple hours, 50 years exactly since the landing back on Earth of the crew of Apollo 17, which was the last NASA mission to the moon, for which I was present at the launch on a ship offshore anchored with this incredible first and last night launch of the Apollo program, the Saturn V. There was actually video of that that was taken by our documentary film crew, which I did not have time to post it, and poor Keith would have killed me if I had, so we will do that for another time. But it's kind of interesting to watch what this thing looked like from offshore at night. But literally 50 years ago tonight, to the night, this is the half century anniversary of the end of the Apollo era and the beginning of the Artemis generation. And if you think NASA was not totally aware of that and made that happen despite all those delays, then you and I don't occupy the same radio space tonight. Anyway, items from 7 on involve the details of the Orion mission and some of the really fascinating and extraordinary data that we have now kind of gone through. And so rather than take up the time at the beginning of the show here, let me in the first couple of 10 minutes add my guest tonight to the list. Let me see. I have to click on something. What do I click on? Here we are. Okay. Not in any particular order. Roger Braun is joining us. He is our resident generalist. Again, all these people's bios are available if you click on fast links to bios. Andrew Curry is with us. Andrew is a professional artist. He has worked for major film companies, television documentaries. He's done storyboards for Super Bowl ads, and he also has a master's in art therapy. And so we have used his expertise to try to psychoanalyze the extraordinary lunar paintings from Alan Bean, who was the lunar module pilot on Apollo 12, and who kept giving us what's really on the moon for decades when nobody would listen directly, but they do see it in his paintings if they know what to look for. Speaking of art, Kinthea is with us. We haven't had Kinthea with us for a long time. She is the art director of the Enterprise mission and The Other Side of Midnight, and she has her own show called The Other Side of the News, which she has helmed now for well over a year, which takes positions that I don't, but that's what makes horse races, as my grandmother also would have said. So I'm a firm believer in the First Amendment. Oh, boy, do I believe in the First Amendment. Anyway, then we've got Keith Morgan with us, who is, as you know, worked for Ted Koppel and is now giving his extraordinary expertise and patience to both shows, The Other Side of Midnight and The Other Side of the News. And he will obviously have some thoughts on what he sees tonight. John Womack is with us. John is a graphic expert, graphic designer. He has had personal experience with, shall we say, out of dimension, out of body experiences, has ranged beyond the earth and has seen some things that actually have been kind of correlated and corroborated by some other remote viewers. And I think one of the things he's going to talk about tonight is how that expertise fits into the bigger picture. Robert Morningstar is back with us. Now, Robert is a civilian intelligence analyst. And if that sounds a bit kind of diametrically opposed, it's not. He's also many other things. He knows photo interpretation, geometric analysis. He is a private pilot. He's an expert in Chinese languages, history, and martial arts. Anyway, he's another basically a generalist and has been a friend and colleague of mine for far too many years. When I used to live across the river, he would come and visit me from his palatial estate there on the shores of the Hudson River. Just kidding, Robert. Just kidding. Okay. And last but not least is Barbara Honegger. Now, Barbara is interesting because she is the only one of us assembled tonight that has actual real-world political experience in Washington. And that's why I asked her to be on tonight, even though at the moment she is holding a dinner party. And I guess all her guests are kind of, listening in the background. So what I like to do, given that all of what we're going to talk about tonight depends on open public disclosure, I want her to give us a kind of a political update on where we stand with what I think is probably the most important thing that will happen in the realm of making everything you're going to hear and see tonight openly public, on the public record, acknowledged by the mainstream, and that is the president signing the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act imminently, within days, if not a week or two. So without further ado, Barbara Honegger, please come on down.
Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
You can hear me.
We can hear you fine.
Yeah. Well, this is very exciting because you didn't mention it, but we have on previous shows, and that's why you wanted me to come on again tonight to repeat, because it's so important, that the authorization for the use of military force, the AAUM Act, has been passed by both houses of Congress. And it's now gone to President Biden to sign, and he will, of course, sign it. There are a couple of provisions in it that he doesn't like, but that's okay because it's a veto-proof majority in both houses, so he will sign it. And once he signs it, your listeners who've heard the previous shows know, that there is a section in it. When I was on with you and Steve Bassett, a couple of shows we've had on this, that there is an extremely important section. You can probably tell me the number. I can't remember it. But there's an incredibly important section of the bill that's about to be signed by Biden into law that requires, that opens up and requires a very serious advance in the UAP, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon investigation and public reporting. So that's number one. But probably just as important as that, almost simultaneously with that being passed in the House, as I recall, House or Senate, which was a couple of weeks ago when we were on the previous show with Steve Bassett, that was when Biden very kind of quietly signed an executive order, which in essence, in gist, states that the Department of Justice and the Biden administration, the government, executive branch, will no longer be demanding, mandating journalists, and they refer to it as members of the, quote, media, unquote, will no longer force or try to force members of the media to turn over their notes or records or any documents relating to their discussions with secret sources, including if the information they receive is classified. So this is an incredible advance. Because, let's put two and two together, let's connect the dots. Once the AUMS goes into effect.
I'll tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour, so why don't we hold it there, because we don't want to, this is an important punchline, we don't want to shortchange it, okay?
Okay.
My guest this morning, my first guest is Barbara Honegger, resident of the Reagan White House, well-versed in policy in Washington, explaining why everything you're going to see tonight and what you've seen in many past shows can come out of NASA fully legal and covered with an impenetrable legal shield that the folks inside showing us the real imagery, the real data, the folks in the Air Force, in the other military parts of the establishment who had interesting interactions with UFOs or UFO technology or any of the things that go bump in the night, they can go public with zero legal repercussions. But what will incentivize them is they also, if they talk to the media, they can make $1 million in their spare time. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Welcome to the land of free enterprise.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
What is the real story?
And we are back. Gosh, I keep hitting the wrong pots here. There we are. Sorry. So, Barbara, this is an incredible backdrop to an incredible mission because, as we're going to prove throughout the night, they have been lying and lying and lying about even the photographs from Artemis. They've been, you know, doing weird things. They've been compressing them, draining them the color, giving us lousy resolution. I mean, there's no way these images are 4K resolution from several of 16 cameras that this spacecraft carried. But all that doesn't matter because in a few days, when the president signs this 2023 NDAA, legally, if there are folks inside that want to tell the American people and the world the truth, there will be no legal impediment to them sharing any data on extraterrestrial ruins that exist on the moon that they wish to. And believe me, there's a lot of ruins to share. So please continue.
Right. Well, as I understand it from the show with Steve Bassett, and he read the critical sections of the bill that's about to become law. Technically, it explicitly applies, let's put it that way, to any information that has been required by someone's supervisor not to be released to the public, that all of those non-disclosure orders are vacated.
Because, sorry, Barbara, someone is clicking. Would someone please mute their mic? I'm hearing someone, you know, cracking peanuts or walnuts or something.
I didn't hear that. Okay. So the bill that's about to become law explicitly refers to any inside the government information, that would include DOD and presumably also NASA, that has anything to do directly, or I would probably argue indirectly, with the unidentified aerial phenomenon / ET.
Well, remember, the law also covers all the contractors. And for decades, we've all looked to Lockheed Martin as the place in private industry where the bodies are buried, and which you can't get information out of through FOIA, because technically, up until this law is signed, contractors are immune to, you know, requests for Freedom of Information Acts. No longer, anybody who wishes to spill the beans in any of these subcontractor companies, these BAF corporations that know everything, including stunning things about free energy technologies derived from ET spacecraft and hyperdimensional transit systems and secret space, for all of this can come out because they will all have legal cover once the president signs this bill in days. Well,
yeah, I want to put a caveat on that, though. It's kind of a big one. The way I understand the language that Steve Bassett read, and you can double check this, is that what this bill, when it becomes law, would open up is for anyone on the inside of the Pentagon, presumably NASA, contractors throughout the government, government contractors, DOD contractors, NASA contractors, et cetera. It enables them to freely, without any retaliation, report to this special office in the Pentagon. That's not the same thing as going public. Now, that's why I added the important addition of President Biden's new executive order, the new policy that says anybody And anybody means government, inside the government, outside the government. Anybody who gives leaks, etc., even classified information to someone in the media, the American media, that they will not go after the media for their notes and records. However, if it's classified information and the government finds out about it, they can still put you in jail for that. So it's not completely open door, but you put those two together and the door is cracked really big.
It's a huge opening. It's like, you know, give them an inch, they'll take a mile. Because remember, we still live in a free enterprise society where if someone wants to make a lot of money and become historical figures, you know, remember Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden did huge services to the American people by showing them the depths of the so-called deep state and citizen, you know, monitoring and, you know, mobile phone data and, you know, all that stuff. And then he had to flee to another country. Well, Snowden now would not have to flee if he was to, in these areas, reveal to congressional committees, to supervisors, to people up the chain, people in the White House. In other words, this is such a crack in the door basically after this bill is signed will be non-existent, because I guarantee you, if it doesn't come out the front door, it will, with enterprising reporters, pun intended, will come out the back.
Right, and what's fascinating to me is that there's a major movement now because of Biden's new executive order and new policy, there's a movement to have Biden basically withdraw the case against for extradition of Assange, because after all, you know, all Assange did was give the information to the media and let the media determine what to put out.
How interesting.
So this may have something to do with Assange, and I think you're correct that if Snowden hadn't yet done his leaks and he were still in the United States, that this would be considerable a motivation for him to go to the media even more than he did originally.
Any way you slice it, and of course Steve likes to slice it very, very fine. That's why we love him. This is going to be an extraordinary new era in what's going on, and people will be able to support their claims with actual evidence. In this case, what's on the moon was real stunning imagery that will not be deniable. And if all that fails, so let's assume that everything that Barbara and I just talked about does not work. You've got Musk and 8 civilians who are not covered by any non-disclosure agreement anywhere written at any time, going into orbit around the moon. And most of them are artists, visual artists. There's professional photographers like this gal from England. And if they don't see these damn ruins, then maybe somebody else should be sent. But I guarantee you they're going to see them. And before the end of the show, I'm going to lay out a potential set of scenarios which you, our beloved audience, can help us put this across the finish line. You're being in the arena. You're playing at your A game tonight is going to be critically important on the next phase of what's to come. Okay, Barbara, I want to thank you.
I need to make one other comment here to kind of close the circle, if I could.
Go for it.
Go ahead. Hello?
Can you hear us?
Oh. Yeah, I can hear you. Shall I go ahead?
Yeah, by all means.
Oh, okay. I just couldn't hear you. All right. So I want to be clear. First, I want to be clear about something. And second, I want to add the final piece of this puzzle to close the circle. I want to be clear that when this new bill becomes law, that anybody who's in the system, who knows anything about anything related to UAPs, UFOs, ETs, ball lightning, you know, orbs, whatever, that they are free now without retaliation to report only, as I understand it, to this new office in the Pentagon. Now that office in the Pentagon can decide not to tell the public. However, anybody who from the inside, if you're listening to this program, if now, as soon as it becomes law, go to that office and report it, and immediately go to the mainstream media. Because but protect yourself when you go to the mainstream media, because they're going to pay attention when you tell them, I just reported this to this special office in the Pentagon that has been enabled by the new AUMF.
Exactly.
And the media is going to pay attention. Now, here's the final piece of the puzzle. All of that information is supposed to go into the committees in the Congress. Now, those committees in the Congress have classified sessions and they have public sessions about this, the reports from this special office in the Pentagon, okay? Now, they're going to get classified information that they don't think should be made public, and that they're going to be told by that special office in the Pentagon that's getting all this new information from people who now have this freedom to do it. They're not going to be revealing it all to the public. However, the members of that committee, we need to put it out on our website, on your website, the members of that committee, because a single member of that committee who wants the information to be made public and is willing to risk their seat on the committee, if it's important enough, under the Supreme Court decision called U.S. versus Gravel, Gravel being in former, my friend and former neighbor, the late Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska, who lived right here on the Monterey Peninsula for years before he passed away a few years ago. This court case, Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Gravel, is very clear that any sitting member of Congress, and I'm talking about the members of the committee that will be getting the classified information from this new office in the Pentagon on UAPs, et cetera, any member of Congress who's willing to risk their seat on the committee and maybe even their seat in Congress in the next election, if it's important enough, they can go on the floor of the House or the Senate, and U.S. versus Gravel Supreme Court decision says nothing can be done to retaliate against them legally by any other branch of the government, including the executive branch and DOJ.
Including maybe Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who, of course, is already threatening to take certain people off committees for just parting their hair on the wrong side.
Well, yeah, and he probably would. And that's what I'm saying. If the information is important enough, may not be your favorite person, but, Liz Cheney. If it's important enough and you're willing, a member of Congress, see some classified information from this special new office in the Pentagon and feels they're willing to put their job in Congress on the line, certainly their committee assignment on the line, they can go public on the floor of the House or the Senate or in any House or Senate committee meeting and spill the beans that's in their memory from being inside those classified hearings in Congress. They can go public and spill the beans and nothing can be done to them.
Wow. Okay, Barbara took time out from her dinner party. You may return to your dinner party. I understand you're having enchiladas. I'll be right over after the show.
Okay, good. We're looking forward to it.
So we return you to your regularly scheduled dinner party. Thank you. Okay, I'll tell you what, before we get to our next guest, let me give you a little background. Again, you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on tonight's banner. That takes you to the show page, the guest page for tonight's show. Under that, you'll see where it says fast links to items. Click on my name. That takes you to my section of the page. And you're going to want to look down at number 8. We're going to skip 7 for a minute here because we're going to come back to 7 when I bring John Womack on. Number 8. This is a plain, ordinary garden variety eclipse of a total eclipse by the moon of the sun. And as you're going to see later on in the morning, you know, we've known that there was something bizarre going on with the moon. Forget the sun. Forget, you know, look at the moon. For 171 years. I will document that shortly. And what it is that because the Earth's orbit around the sun is not a perfect circle, and the moon's orbit around the Earth is not a perfect circle, when you have eclipses, which roughly happen in 2 seasons per year, around spring and around fall, when the sun, moon, and Earth all line up in terms of their orbital planes, you get this period of totality, which can vary from, you know, a few seconds to almost 7 minutes when the moon is closest and the Earth is closest to the sun and that kind of thing in its orbit. And then it can actually get far enough away so that you don't get a total eclipse. You basically have the moon in the middle of a bright ring of fire, the photosphere of the sun. That's called an annular eclipse. Annular, ring, annulus, annular, year, orbit, circle going around. It's all related in Latin. Anyway, but if you look at that picture, if you click on it and make it bigger, it's obvious now of everything we know that that is an incredible backlit picture of the dome around the entire moon. And every time I say that, I can hear people fainting. Did he just say there was a dome covering the whole damn moon, all 2,000-mile diameter of it, all 15 million square mile surface area? Yes, 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 because back to Arthur Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, meaning that if you introduced an F-35 to a Neanderthal, he would think it was something out of heaven, out of hell, out of someplace, not of this earth, because it would be so extraordinary to see it performing and totally beyond his ability to figure out how it worked. What did you expect we would find when we first encountered ETs? Something that we could easily understand? Of course not. By definition, they, whoever they are, and there's more than one they, are going to be so many light years ahead of us in terms of capabilities, in terms of consciousness, in terms of understanding the real universe, that even if you don't invoke all of the theories that we have posed over the years about us being kind of, you know, kept in the dark and kept down on the farm, and as Charles Fort said, we are property, even if you discount all of that, if you have different evolutionary rates going on with different species, even in the same galaxy, the guys that are going to find you are the guys that are more advanced than you are, because if you could travel to them, by definition, you would be more advanced than they are. So whoever comes here is going to be, by definition, more advanced, certainly technically, and maybe spiritually, psychologically, in terms of consciousness, in terms of being plugged into higher dimensions, whatever. As will be their ruins. So we've encountered ruins right next door on the moon. And for 50 years, tonight, literally 50 years, half a century, NASA has done everything in its power to keep the rest of the planet, the rest of humanity, from knowing what it found on the moon. That's the background context for tonight's discussion. Okay. So now we go to number 9. This also happens to be the weekend when, for the next few days, Mars is closer to us, the planet beyond the moon. As you can see in that brilliant compilation by a guy named McCarthy, Andrew McCarthy, who was an amateur astronomer, who was anticipating photographing the moon occulting Mars, meaning moon's orbiting the Earth. Mars is much farther away, tens of millions of miles. The moon in its orbit moves from right to left, and it crosses Mars, and for a period of like about an hour, it's behind Mars, and then it comes out the other side. And it turned out that this particular occultation was when the phase of the moon was almost a full moon. So the Mars went behind the bright side and came out on a bright side, but there's a little bit of shadow remaining on the right side, so that it was, you could actually see Mars rising above a glimmer of a dark horizon on the moon. All very spectacular, and we're going to show some images shortly here. The reason that I'm doing this way is because tonight, this weekend, is again when Mars is closest, and it's going to be for another 15 or so years, and one of our panelists, Ron Gerbrun, who really has a thing about Mars, I said to him, what we're going to do is we're going to segue from what's on the moon to the most interesting stuff you're going to see on Mars that's also going to come out as part of this NDAA disclosure process, where people like a JPL, like Andrew Curry and I have been discussing for months and months and months, years, why you can have all these brilliant, genius people at JPL looking at all kinds of ruins on the Perseverance images, and nobody says anything. Well, after the president signs this law, they will be able, in full conscience, to say something and back it up with images and real analysis. I mean, have I gotten the point across that we're on the edge? I'm thinking of a famous book here, The Edge of Forever, that we're on the edge of something so astonishing historically, where all the pent-up secrets are about to have a platform where they can come out of the closet, mixing our metaphors madly, and be widely available for the general audience, the general public, the general population of the world. All right, moving on, and we need to move rather with alacrity here. Items 10 and 11 are a wide angle from Andrew McCarthy, the amateur astronomer who did the beautiful composite in number 9, showing Mars as it exited from behind the moon. We rotated the image so the moon is like down, because we find out that from the experiments at Harvard that people see geometry better if it's up, down, left, right, the way normal reality presents itself to us. Now you're going to see that around the moon there are a series of isobars of luminosity. That is backscatter from the dome. Let me repeat that. That you're literally looking at the moon with the sun right behind you. So the light is coming over your shoulder. It's bouncing off the moon, coming directly back like one of those, you know, zero reflection signs. And then it's continuing on to Mars, tens of millions of miles further away, and coming back so that Mars basically is a full Mars. It's a not a gibbous Mars, not a crescent Mars, which we can never see. It's a full Mars, okay? Now, item number 11 is a close-up at the top, of which I put an inset in. If you click on that and look at the bottom of the Mars image, you see that little white trace of a line parallel to the horizon of the moon and parallel to that dark shadow from the ridge in front of that shadow? That's the densest refracting part of the remaining lunar dome on the Earth side of the moon. It shows up even as planets are occulted behind the limb of the moon, depending upon the state of libration of the moon. And you can see it right there, again, if you know what you're looking for. Item number 12. Now, one of the really cool things about the Artemis mission was that they arranged, and again, it wasn't the happenstance, wasn't arbitrary, wasn't because they had nothing better to do. They arranged the orbit of the spacecraft, and that's why, if you go back to my item number, let me get it up here, item number 5, this will kind of give you the background geometric layout of how these orbits work. They're not, by the way, to scale. That's a schematic. It's not to scale. But when they put that spacecraft into its far orbit, what they call the distant retrograde orbit, on the far side of the moon, meaning that depending upon the angle of the sun, it was like a gibbous moon with the light coming in from the left. By the way, all the NASA images are upside down for some reason. I think it's just basically to confuse us. So what I had John do was turn everything upside down, so it's now right side up, because the moon was moving to the right, the spacecraft Orion moving to the left. It was causing the moon to move in front of the sun, which was a quarter million miles away from the moon and about 50,000 miles further away from the Orion spacecraft. Anyway, so 12 and 13 and 14 show comparisons of this space.com video, which is up listed up there in raw form in item number 7. You might want to look at that first and then look at these details, and then you're going to want to look at John's version. Because what's really interesting is that as you restore all the data in the video that NASA took out before they gave it to space.com, you find that the far side of the moon, the side covered in glass, most of which is still intact, is incredibly colorful And if you continue on down, you'll see in examples 13 and 14, that particularly in 13, when the Earth is coming out from behind the moon, right at the edge of the moon, there's this brilliant green flash, which is caused by what we call prismatic refraction in the glass dome, which is covering like a shell, like wrapping the moon in saran wrap. It's about that thick. But at the right angles, you get these incredible color and luminosity changes. What I had John do was to basically take and work with the space.com video and put the color back in and wait till you see when he comes on what he's going to see. Now, who has shown it to us first? By the way, if you look at the details in 13, remember I keep saying that NASA keeps hiding stuff? I want you to look at the details on the moon in number 13. Then look at the details on the Earth. They've not been messing with the Earth in this frame. They have been messing with the moon because there's almost no detail. Why don't they want us to see the detail on the far side of the moon? Why would they blur it out? Obviously, it was selectively, deliberately blurred. The good thing is they didn't know not to mess with the color. So the colors are accurate. It's the detail. They said, oh, we got to bury the detail because, of course, from all photography, you know, the devil is in the details, right? Number 14, you see how capricious they are. Number 14, the GoPro cameras, that's pretty much what you see. And it's only taken, you know, a few minutes after the one in 13 with the moon farther to the left. For some reason, they left that version alone. And you can see limited detail, but it's much more than in 13 on the moon. Now, number 15, this is what you get when you compare different space programs, because 15 is from the Chinese, taken by one of their unmanned satellites called, I believe, Mocking Bridge or something, which was a relay satellite put up so they could communicate with their Chang 5 spacecraft landing on the far side of the moon. If you zoom in on that, you're going to find something really interesting, which, of course, we don't have time in this segment to talk about, but we will when we return. So what I will say is we're laying all this, as the lawyers say, as foundation, because when we return, we're going to bring on more panelists, and they will share with you what they have found in the NASA data from Artemis from the moon. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
Exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight for this Sunday night, December 11th. The return of Artemis, the 50th anniversary, literally to the day or the night of when Apollo 17 returned from the last human manned Apollo mission to the moon.
If you have an enlarged...
Well, we don't want to do that. No, we don't want to do that at all. Okay, so back to our program. If you go back to number 15, click on number 15, because this is really important, and you're going to scan to the left and right. Look at the Earth as it's rising behind this far side vision from the unmanned Chinese spacecraft that was put into orbit to actually act as a communications relay for their unmanned Chang 5 mission. Chang 4. Notice that the Earth has a brilliant thing covering it, encroaching onto the lunar surface. That's magnified light coming from the clouds of the Earth, because this acts like a lens. And then notice there's this dark band above the bright line. That's some kind of upper level of the dome, which is absorbing light. It's not acting like a lens. It's acting like some kind of an absorption layer, either as a filter to screen the surface from ultraviolet, or maybe as both a filter and as a way to basically draw power from the sun. Can you imagine the amount of solar energy that you could store, soak up and store, if you have an energy collector literally the size of the diameter of the moon facing the sun, you know, with 15 million square miles of area, if it was properly ducted into batteries or energy reserves or some kind of storage mechanism. I mean, this is just absolutely astonishing. So what you want to do now is you want to look at 16, because what I've done on 16 is to basically show a vision of a rotated. Actually, we're missing one slide here. I wonder how that happened. Probably on my mistake. Anyway, we're missing one slide in between, which shows you the moon disappearing on the right-hand side. I'm sorry, the Earth disappearing on the right-hand side of the moon just before it goes into eclipse. And this is what you're seeing in 16, rotated 90 degrees. So again, like in the occultation images, the moon is below and space is above. And these are two parts of the Earth, which are just the final slivers sticking out behind the curve of the moon before it goes into totality. And what you find, which is really astonishing, and I may try to get that up on another version of this imagery, what you find is that the Earth, as it goes behind the moon, the last visible remnants of the Earth take on incredible color, just like in the left-hand panel of this two-frame composite, which is a sunset photograph from the International Space Station orbiting the Earth. The Earth atmosphere acts like a gaseous lens. Well, gaseous lens, real lens, glass lens, refraction is refraction is refraction, and prismatic dispersion of light according to wavelength or frequency is the same. So the same phenomenon is going on around the moon, but of course we know the moon cannot have an atmosphere, so that only leaves one final explanation. It's got to be the refractive properties, the dome. So then you go to 17, and this is a comparison of an Apollo 17 image on the left with a view of the Golden Gate and sunset on the right. In the sunset atmosphere, when the sun is behind you and it's going down, you get this incredible prismatic display on the atmosphere in front of you, 180 degrees opposite the sunset, of the refraction that you see in the left-hand side of number 16, except instead of looking directly at the sunset, you're looking at the backscattering from the atmosphere, basically acting like a movie screen. The same thing can be seen when it should not be visible on the moon. On the left-hand panel, you see the astronaut's shadow. He's taking the picture. I think that's Gene Cernan taking the picture. In the middle distance, you see the lunar module. Then you see South Massive to the left, and you see more mountains a far distance to the right. And then between them, extending to the top of the frame, is the same multicolored band of colors from sunset on the moon. In other words, the opposite, you're looking opposite the view in the right panel of 16, because instead of standing on the moon looking toward the setting Earth, you'd be standing on the moon looking away from it, seeing this color. Of course, it'd be very faint because the sunlight is 10,000 times brighter than the Earth-lit moon, the Earth light from the Earth shining on the moon. So all of this then produces the effect that you see in item 18. On the left, you can see this view from the Orion spacecraft of the moon as the Earth is just about to disappear behind the right-hand edge. And in the upper sliver, particularly, if you click on it, it gets much bigger. It's pink. Where the heck did the pink come from? The Earth is blue and white. There's no color, certainly not in the phase aspect. And then, of course, what I've done here is to create a composite so you can see that actually, if you're looking at a glass structure, that's what the object is on the right. This is the Crystal Palace in Madrid. It's kind of like one of those old Victorian palaces they used to build to hold expositions, all made of iron girders and glass. Well, this is in Madrid. It exists now. These are photographs taken inside. That's the scale. See the human being there. You get incredible prismatic refractions. You know, the edges of the glass panes refract light differently. You get all kinds of red, green, and blues. But you also get pastels, which now is the upper inset panel on the left in that frame next to the moon, next to the Earth disappearing behind the moon. And that's what we're seeing on the moon, because if you have a planet covered with glass, you're going to get all different angles and refractions and overlapping colors. And that shows you literally what in a glass structure, all that overlapping multiple color bouncing around produces in the way of pastels. And they look identical to what you're seeing on the far side of the moon. Which brings me to my final slide, which is number 19. It turns out that in 1851, on July 28th, an astronomer named Johann Julius Friedrich Berkowski took the first daguerreotype, very primitive form of photography, image of a total solar eclipse. If you look carefully, you can see in black and white on this 171-year-old image, every aspect of the dome around the moon that for almost 200 years now, every astronomer, both professional and amateur, has totally ignored because it literally was not within their purview to imagine something this extraordinary could in fact exist around or over every aspect of the moon that we can see. So without further ado, Jonathan Womack, who is an expert in computer graphics among many other things, has taken the imagery from space.com, who took it from NASA, from the raw footage from Orion, has put it together to show you in three-dimensional color, in motion picture color, what it is that NASA, before the signing of the NDAA, is being forced by some powers to deny to the American taxpayer, to the American people. John, take it away.
Hi, Richard. This is a good time to mention that you did a wonderful six-hour documentary in 2019. And on your homepage, theothersideofmidnight.com, there's a banner that says, you know, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. And you've shown a few bits of it tonight, but that's 6 hours of very interesting research and data that you've collected over the years and put together. I love that presentation. So if tonight's show interests you, I highly recommend you go and watch that documentary. It's on a number of platforms. I recommend going to paraflix.com. You can sign up for the free trial and watch it. But that's a wonderful show. So you want me to go through my slides real quick, Richard?
Yep.
Okay, slide number one. Ingo Swann is famous for doing a lot of moon remote viewing for the CIA, and he was a friend of I work with Russell Targ, who was the co-founder of Stanford Research Institute in the 70s, 1972. And so in 1973, they did an experiment, Ingo and Russell and Hal Puthoff, who's Russell's partner. And they had a gentleman there from NASA. I can't think of his name. But they asked Ingo, and this was on a Saturday. It was they weren't on the clock, and that was intentional. And they asked Ingo to have a look at Jupiter because they have had a Voyager. They had launched a Voyager craft, I believe it was, that was going to take pictures of Jupiter in about 8 months' time.
Yeah, John, what year was this again?
1973.
You're talking about the Pioneer spacecraft, which preceded Pioneers 10 and 11 went to Jupiter first.
Yes. So he drew a wonderful sketch and then listed 12 items that notable items. And one of them was that there were rings around Jupiter. And science had balked, scientists, you know, mainstream scientists had balked at this idea in the past, but you say, no, there are rings, there's crystallized particles forming these rings, and moreover, as you move your consciousness inside the atmosphere of Jupiter, you find that invisible to the naked eye and telescopes, there's another ring around Jupiter that would appear to be in the sky. And moreover, there is a solid core inside Jupiter where there are mountains rising to, he estimates, 30,000 feet of elevation. So there's a lot going on Jupiter. Six of his 12 items were confirmed by 1975, and some of them have yet to be confirmed, but he then went to look in a separate experiment with the CIA. And this is all detailed in his book called Penetration. And the Penetration is a reference to him remote viewing the moon. And he is seeing the moon for some reason is allowing him to see into another dimension that is very close to ours, but it's vibrating at a slightly different rate. And his viewings were all had this quality where there'd be a ripple or a waver as he's watching these other people work on the moon. He sees machines. He sees all this infrastructure. He said that the moon cannot be a natural object because it's hollow. And if you have a chance to read his book, Penetration, I highly recommend it. There's some astonishing finds on there. So, there's his book. Item number two is the cover of his book there, Penetration. And 2A, in fact, is that slide with it has his sketch that he drew that day in April of 1973. And let's see, item three. Oh, this is one of your slides, Richard, from the Apollo 50th anniversary landing on the moon documentary I just mentioned that you can watch on Paraflix. And a year ago, Richard, you asked me to put together a 3D model, scaled and so forth, of the sun, the earth, and the moon. And you wanted to recreate the sun, the moon eclipsing the sun, and you know you get this light around the moon.
Well, the idea was that we put in basic parameters of glass because the Apollo samples tell us that about 50% by weight of the rocks that the astronauts brought home and the fines, the soil, the regolith, it's glass and it's silicon dioxide. So we're dealing with ordinary glass So you take the refractive index of glass, you make a shell like 20, 30 miles high, you make multiple layers in it, you wrap it around the whole moon, you give it a computer program that tells how to deal with refraction and geometry and light bending and the distances, and you then stand back and let it run and you see what you see.
Yeah, I was objecting to this project because, as you can see in the slides here, like items 5 through, gosh, how many do I have here? Like 5 through 11, let's say 5 through 12. I'm showing you how many different adjustments there are and different parameters for recreating these in a simulated 3D, a 3D simulation. And I didn't feel I had the expertise to apply the real-time, you know, NASA data of, you know, the output of the moon. And I mean, there's like 100 different factors I felt that I would have to verify and just search out with and apply to this program. I use Element 3D. And I think I said to you, we should get somebody from MIT or something who would jump on this. I'm too busy. And you said, just keep it simple. Just make, the moon in the air. Put a light behind the moon. Line it up. And, like you said, put a little glass rim. It would be about 10 miles high, I think you said. And, let's see what it looks like. Forget all the other adjustments and so forth. So those are slides 14, 15, and 16, and then 17. And indeed, without doing much work, just keeping it very simple, you can see, yes, the light is shining behind the moon. The moon is eclipsing the sun. And you do get the refraction effect, you can see there. And
fascinating.
Wow. Slides. Yeah, I mean, you could really, if somebody wanted to put the time into this, I don't know if any listeners out there are 3D modelers, but it'd be a cool, fun project for somebody that teaches at the Rhode Island School of Design or that kind of thing.
Or the Pasadena. We used to work with a group at the Pasadena School of Design. I'm glad you mentioned that. I haven't talked to them in years. Maybe they'd be interested. Okay.
Hmm. Awesome. 18, 19, and 20, I just took still images when I was doing this video. Richard asked me to do a short video.
Well, what I asked you to do is take the NASA video and do what NASA had done, but do it in reverse. In other words, what they've done is they've drained out all the color to make it look as boring and dull and gray as all the Apollo images that they've tinkered with. And I simply said, based on the raw live video I saw from the cameras that morning as they were closing in on their first pass around the moon, I said, just put the color back in. And if you want to hype it a little bit, you know, amp it up so people can see it easily, do that. We'll tell everybody what you're doing. But remember, as David Sarita said on that first Artemis show a couple of weeks ago, you can't put color into a photograph that doesn't have the color. When you amplify it, when you saturate it, when you bring out what's there, all you're doing is bringing out the data that's already resident in the image. You're not making it up.
Exactly. So that video is item number 22, and you can watch. It's, I think, 4 minutes long, and there's some interesting image there for sure.
Well, why did you click on it, and why did you narrate what you see? Because as an artist, as a graphics person, I'm sure you were as mind-boggled as I was that what I was looking for is blatantly visible. In other words, science is nothing if it's not prediction. If the moon is covered, certainly on the far side, with it heavily eroded on the near side, by a shell of glass with multiple levels, then what you're going to see primarily as it interacts with sunlight is not the surface features, the detail. You're going to see the light patterns, the interference, light waves in the glass, like I showed up in that, Crystal Palace in Madrid. And as you're moving at thousands of miles per hour relative to the moon, that angle between the spacecraft cameras, the moon, and the sun is going to change. And in the close-in orbits, it's going to change within minutes. That's like watching paint dry. So what I said to John was, just speed it up. Let's look at this in fast motion and see if we see interesting changes in the period of a few minutes. If you can compress, let's say, the 90-minute eclipse by the moon of the Earth down to 3 or 4 minutes. And that's what he did in 22. So, John, take it away and narrate what you see in the video in 22.
Well, the colors are obvious. And where my mind was as I watched this was actually Delicate Arch in Utah, because part of the function of that arch or portal is to capture moonlight. And I thought, geez, wouldn't it be interesting to learn that when this arch was created long, long ago, the dome was intact. So the effect would have been, the arch's effect of capturing the moonlight would have been much greater. And
now that's
so
an interesting idea.
Yeah, I was thinking of it in terms of the arches and what this would, how this would affect them, because I'm trying to decode how to turn on these arches so you can, like Delicate Arch, Russell goes, yeah, that's the one where you step through it and you fall off the cliff. I said, well, you have to turn on the arch first, and then you step through it and you're fine.
In other words, it's some kind of a stargate or a portal through another dimension to someplace else in your model.
Yes, I think within our own solar system on a number of planets.
But you don't know that.
I don't know.
Remember, there are no such things as straight lines in space, so you could step through here and wind up in Andromeda.
Yes, I think it can also take you to places very, very far away. One of the things that Ingo mentions in his book Penetration is that he sees a number of these bridges on the moon, and he does not understand what the function is. They're not bridges as we understand them. And then one in particular, he calls it's a bridge to nowhere. It arches out of this crater, and it just stops, and it doesn't go across anywhere.
Oh, it's like
stops.
Sarah Palin's bridge in Alaska. Remember the big political fuss over the bridge to nowhere in Alaska?
No. No. But, yeah, I think...
Well, maybe it's an unfinished portal. And remember, just because they're ETs or aliens doesn't mean they don't, pull all their pants one leg at a time, all 20 legs or whatever.
Yeah. Yes, and it seems to be that he was seen interdimensionally. He's looking into a dimension where there's other people that are looking back at him, but there's also the ETs that are kind of the bosses of our solar system, I guess, might be a word, or the engineers or this sort of thing. So we're dealing with two levels of intelligences here.
Did he get the impression he was looking back through time or looking cross dimensions at something simultaneous, another like parallel reality where the moon didn't undergo the war and it's still functioning the way it was designed and the solar system is intact, et cetera, et cetera?
Simultaneous. That's exactly right, yes.
So parallel worlds.
Parallel dimension, and they could see him and pointed at him, and he freaked out. and this is like his book. He wrote a book called Starfire in the 70s, and that book was very memorable to me because it's about a psychic who has a lot of power, and the government finds out about him. And the one thing the government has been afraid of all these years is telepathy, because telepathy is the language of the universe. It's how the ETs speak and so on. And for some reason that Ingo could not understand is that we have this mass consciousness on Earth that seems to avoid that whole, you know, certain subjects. That's one of them. And why is that? We should be embracing telepathy research because that's going to get us the ticket into the club and into the galactic community. And once we learn how to communicate telepathy, then the aliens will come talk to us. But
and then we're going to segue in the next half hour to Andrew, and we're going to talk about phantom zones and are we in prison, and is somebody wanting to keep us in prison? And you know, Ingo and others of his ilk, like you, have the abilities to, in terms of frequency, penetrate the shield and see the real reality behind the artificialness in which we're being forced at the moment to live.
Richard, can you hear me?
Yes, Barbara. Hi.
Yeah, I'd like to share a quick story about Ingo Swann.
Oh, cool. Dinner must have a break.
No, I didn't have a dinner party. We were just having our dinner.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I knew Ingo Swann because I was at Stanford University for many years, undergraduate and graduate at large, and Russell Park was a very close friend and colleague of mine. In fact, he nominated me, and I became the second president of the parapsychology research group there in the Stanford Palo Alto area, and he was the first, I was the second. This was, the organization that was created by him and the famous astronaut. But anyway, so I knew Ingo Swann from the SRI experiment, Ingo and Pal Putoff and such, and I earned the first ever accredited graduate degree in consciousness studies and experimental parapsychology in the world, which was at John F. Kennedy University. That was in June of 1981. I got my degree with Manly Hall. So the story with Ingo Swann, and I only learned this after he passed away a few years ago. He lived in New York City. One of my dear friends and colleagues who used to be on our board, is no longer, but she was on our board of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, of which I'm the director of the board, that is Christina Borgeson. She was very close to Ingo Swann, and she knew him as a close personal friend in New York. She was in New Jersey, actually. Still is. And she was one of the few people he allowed to be with him at the very end of his life. He knew he was only had a few days to live. And he invited her to his apartment, and she went there. And he said, "Will you please take this plant?" And it's this huge plant. I could send you a picture of it. And if you want, you can put it up on items.
Yeah, Barbara, we're at the bottom of the hour, so hold it right there, okay?
No, I know. I've got one more sentence. Just one more sentence.
Okay.
Because I can see there's one more minute to the bottom of the hour. And so he gave her that plant. And she said, "What's important about this plant?" And he said, "This plant is the transducer and the amplifier of all of the signals that I get. And it's named Methuselah, and she has it. And she's offered me part of it."
Oh, how interesting. How absolutely interesting. And that brings to mind a FICA story that I will tell when we come back. My guests this morning, too numerous to mention, go to the website and you'll see who they all are. Thank you, Barbara. That's a very interesting story because plants, as part of my hyperdimensional research, turn out to be transducers. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits.
Roger.
Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
So, remote viewer par excellence, Ingo Swann, and others, according to John and Ingo's book, and backed up by Barbara's remarkable story about the plant, you probably don't know, because I haven't told anybody, that in the very beginning of the research that we've been doing into the hyperdimensional physics model, I got so intrigued with a certain ficus in one of the mainstream researchers' offices that he had wired. This is back during the Cleve Baxter era, when it was a big fad to, you know, put galvanometers on all kinds of, you know, animals and plant life and sea creatures and whatever. It's all in Baxter's book. Anyway, this ficus tree got wired during a transit of Mercury across the sun. And as Mercury, the little planet Mercury, apropos of Ray Tolmes last night discussing, you know, 6 and 9 minute cycles at the speed of light, what it takes for the energy from the sun to cross the orbits of Mercury and Venus, and it shows up in radioactive decay rate changes in plutonium. Well, this ficus responded with a galvanometer attached to it in rapid tracings on a graph showing that it somehow was understanding and seeing or sensing the transit of Mercury in front of the sun as seen from Earth, something which we did not confirm with the Accutron for decades. So I can absolutely believe and corroborate Barbara's story that in Ingo Swann's life, a plant was a very important interdimensional transducer of the hyperdimensional physics underlying all of this. Okay, Andrew, you are at bat, and that's not a metaphor. Andrew actually is often at bat. As an artist, as someone who is involved in film and video and all that, when you look at these Orion images, particularly the ones that John has, with the magic of computers, reconstituted in terms of partially what we're going to originally see when the dam breaks and the insiders rush out through the open gates and show us the real stuff, what is your reaction about the moon, the real moon that we've been seeing in this mission?
Well, Richard, before I say anything, I think Barbara had something else just to finish up there.
Thank you, Andrew. I was just going to cut in and say the same thing. I thought maybe there was something wrong with the phone.
Yeah, can you hear me, Richard?
Yes, I can. I thought you
I guess you couldn't before. Just one sentence here. I'm about to send Kinsia and Keith the photo of Methuselah to post on, why don't we go ahead and put it on, is it Jonathan Womack?
Yeah, John is our Ingo contact tonight.
Yeah, so I'm sending that off right now.
Okay, super. Well, thank you so much. Okay, Andrew.
Yeah, so Richard, when we went on to the break, I was looking at the number 20, Jonathan's number 21, the Artemis sample analysis.
Right.
So, I mean, that's stunning. I mean, if that's drawing the color that's really drawing out the color that's really there, it's beautiful, I have to say. I mean, I'm just coming from an artist perspective, but that's stunning work, John. I mean, I think the thing that's bothered me, Richard, is, and I've talked about this with Ron and Robert sort of, you know, off air, that you know, NASA's just been messing these with these images over and over again, and it's very annoying because you just, well, I mean, you have to do all this work to draw to pull anything out. And like you said, I mean, what point do we get when we're finally going to get some honest, well, imagery, and so we can make honest interpretations? I mean,
when
that's
Biden signs the damn NDAA.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question either to you or Barbara. So why is he having to do this? I mean, this seems like a huge step in a – like, is this another slow burn disclosure?
Yes,
I mean,
of course. This is all pre-planned on the ritual timetable. Remember, I've been saying make no wine before it's time. There is a time when we're all supposed to become adults, and yeah. You can't do it before. And I was told this decades ago that this was all locked in stone. And, of course, as an idiot that I was, I didn't believe them. And it took me, you know, half a century to realize that whoever's controlling the calendar and the timetable, they have for their reasons a calendar when this will all become public. But go back to Brookings. What do they say? It's going to take at least a generation, maybe two, before people don't freak out with cats and dogs living together and all that when they find this stuff out. And what was it, Barbara? Hang on a sec. What was it Barbara said the other night? There are certain parts of this that are so terrible we're never supposed to know. Well, I don't buy that for an instant. It may be terrible to the folks inside. Was that Ron?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. I'm building up ahead of curmudgeonliness here. Relative to what Barbara said in the beginning, and thank you, Barbara, that was wonderfully detailed about the way that this NDAA thing works. The problem is that doesn't it piss everybody out there off? Doesn't it even piss you off, Richard, that they think that whoever you want to put the capital T on, that they want to decide when we're adults?
Well, it pisses me off, but there's not a damn thing I can do about it, except I look at what we're about to...
Well, then all this disclosure is meaningless.
No, it's not.
Nothing we can do about it.
No.
Because
you don't know.
See, the thing is...
Going back to McNamara, you don't know what you don't know. My model has been there's a ritual timetable. That's a model.
Yes.
That's not reality. That's my projection based on data that is incomplete. It could be that we're having a huge influence. It could be all these people pushing is finally breaking the dam that would stay in place for another 50 to 100 years if we hadn't pushed.
Yeah, that's just counting on gravity to pull all the water down when the dam breaks.
You are being a curmudgeon. Or you're looking a gift horse in the mouth. Like,
I don't think it's a gift horse. What's the first law of war? No plan survives contact with the enemy.
Okay.
Them, we're the enemy. And so therefore they have to keep adjusting this.
Yeah, their hubris is orders of magnitude beyond anything that we can imagine as civilians. They really think they are masters of the universe and they can control this. And I don't want to disabuse them of the fact that they're wrong. Just let them think they're controlling it and watch what happens.
Do you know what they are? They're psychological plywood. You know what plywood is for? You use a bunch of thin layers because it makes it stronger than a solid piece wood.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, people act like there's one avatar or God figure that's behind all of this. And everybody gets their carts in a row behind it and say, well, we're part of it. We're part of it. We're
See,
part of it.
You're
and they count
arguing
on each
theory.
Other for
you're
mutual
arguing
reinforcement.
Theory. Ron, theory. This is kind of a stupid conversation.
How are you?
No, I'm not.
Nah.
The NDAA is real fact. It's about to be signed. It's going to give people license to tell the truth when the only reason they have is to make a lot of money. Well, that's
you know that non-disclosure agreements don't have to be disclosed.
This,
so therefore,
this obviates them all. Don't you get it? It wipes them away with a clean slate. No matter what they signed, it's irrelevant to the new law. Otherwise, law would never change. New laws supplant old laws all the time. Andrew, you got to break in.
Well, okay, go ahead, Andrew. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to cut into your time. I just got a long list here of clarifications. Go ahead.
Well, I wonder if another part of this, Ron, is the refinement of the delivery system. And Richard mentioned Brookings and, you know, NASA's commissioning of that report. And I just want to go for a little sideline here, which I think relates. So today we were sitting around, we were about to have lunch, and I was sitting with a couple of my kids, and we were watching some NFL football or something. And I flipped the channel because there was commercials, and on comes the Jetsons. And everybody knows the Jetsons.
Oh,
it's
George.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's on. And then, you know, it's a funny little story going on. And in fact, it was George and his dog. What was his dog's name again?
Elroy. Elroy?
Oh, it was. You're right. Okay. And they witness a armed vehicle getting robbed by robbers. Anyways, what it ends up being is the robbers are actors and they're filming a whole thing. And it's the whole thing. But when George goes to bed with his wife, they're in two separate beds.
Yeah, that's the 50s, yes.
Yeah, and I looked over at my young son, he just turned 11, and he kind of looked at me, and I said, you know why they're in separate beds? And he says, aren't they married? And I said, yeah, but that was the times. You didn't show that, especially to children, a man and a woman in bed. My point is—
Actually, the phasing of that goes back to the 30s, where for a time, married people slept in the same bed in the 30s movies, and then the Legion of Decency came in.
Yeah.
And suddenly it became, you know, not good to show married people like Lucy and Ricardo. They slept in separate beds, and then the evolution of clock swung back, and now, of course, almost anything goes. But society takes a long time to evolve. So the fact that it's taken us generations to get to where we're on the threshold of finding out who the hell we are and what we're doing in this place, to me, it's not about being pissed. It's about we're winning. We're winning.
Well, Richard, let me just finish. So, you know, like this sort of idea of one of the things in the Brookings report, they constantly have in their index these studies on the power of television. And you know, there was a lot of worry and a lot of, you know, like interest about, well, what is television doing to people? Like, and I really say, and then one of the other things that in that report I remember reading about was they were very concerned about creating a worldwide network or web to connect communication. And in particular, they were studying very closely the development of, you know, media and communication in sort of more underdeveloped societies. And I really wonder if we've just have to come to a point. Oh, and this is another piece. So when the whole COVID thing was going on and people were being locked in and all that around the world, one of the articles I read about was they were talking about how this became obvious, actually, that large swaths of our earth don't have access to the internet. And it's a big concern for sort of the powers that be. So
Why do you think Musk is spending billions on the Starlink system to wire the whole world? And now he just kind of picked up Twitter because he's got his own platform to put something out when the you-know-what hits the rotating kitchen appliance.
Exactly, Richard. So I just wonder if all this is groundwork to making sure – I've said this before, but it may be in a different context. But this idea of testing the communication networks and making sure almost instantaneously everyone can have the information right away. Now, that's a positive way of looking at it, obviously. But I think it's part of it. Like, even if it is more of a
– Well, look at where he's got his fingers in the pie.
Yeah.
Space flight on the cheap makes it accessible, democratizes it. He's taking 8 civilians who haven't signed a damn thing to look close up at the moon. They're going down to 120 miles. If you can't see as an artist and a photographer what's there on the moon at 120 miles, then you do not belong on the trip. Then he's developing the communications platforms all over the world, Starlink, to beam these images into every damn village and individual cottage on the planet, no matter where you are, in the African belt, in the Siberian steppes, in the depths of England, or in Ukraine. And finally, he's got his arm around Twitter, and what the heck that's all about, I'm not quite sure, but ultimately, that will be there to send forth real images and videos when the time comes.
I think he's got, rather than his arm around, I think he's got his foot up the rear end of. He's trying to destroy it. That's my feeling. He's trying to destroy it on purpose for good reason.
Yeah, but Ron, there's other platforms. The point is that I think we're on to something here. I mean, let's look at your phone, right? Like, you know, when it wasn't working properly, you were gone, and you know, you were lost. That's a hole on our team. And I just think that there's something here about the interconnectivity, and yeah, Richard, again, and maybe it comes down to some sort of moment that has to happen within. I don't know. I mean, you've been speculating about that for like 30 years, and I mean, who knows until it happens. But there's something about this time. Yes, Ron, go.
Yeah, no, relative to what you just said, yes. And I've been terribly lonely because I just, couldn't get in touch with people when I wanted to. And like Blanche DuBois, thanks to the kindness of strangers, I managed to surmount that, and it seems to be working fine. But
I know we're getting close, and I don't want to hog it all up, but you hit on something. So, okay, again, little side story. I'll make it really fast. My wife hosts a party. Well, I guess I'm included because I have to bring out tables and all these things.
Said that so diplomatically.
Yeah.
Hey, I got check marks for watching a movie with her last night, Richard. So she said I was good to come on the show tonight. So anyway.
Hey, he has to live there, Richard. Yeah.
Well, let me just, we have this party just after Christmas, and it's, the darn thing is growing. There are people that we don't even know that hear about it that want to come. And friends of ours who also sends out invitations can't decide, you know, who he should allow to come, because it's just, you know, there's a limit how many people it can be. My point is, people are lonely all over the planet, and there's so much of that going on. And what more could unify us? I mean, Richard, you've talked about this forever. But to see that we are united in this extraordinary, if not demolished, past that can be reborn. I mean, think of how that could, just, you know, fill you with awe and realize that we are a great race, you know, and a race of human beings. And wow, I mean, that would bring us together quick and have us all wanting to chat to each other about a lot of things and not be lonely. I don't know. That's just something that you, by saying that, Ron, you just triggered me there. So
absolutely. And it's, I think it's valid. And it's but it's been like so many other things, that capability has been subverted by people that have somewhat selfish desires relative to it. For instance, people talk about how much time people waste with social media, and yet looking at this phone, which has a really high resolution screen, very brilliant colors, it's hypnotic. I haven't been exposed to this to the extent that most of you have, because I disdain these things.
Oh dear.
And so they.
Nothing. Just come.
Oh yeah. So I stare at my brilliantly colored picture of a cow that I've got on the wallpaper, and I see why people get hooked on these things.
Well,
someone
is
typing. Please mute.
Yeah, someone is typing. And Ron, you bring up something again. So, and Richard brought up, not Stanley Kubrick, but Arthur C. Clarke in 2001, A Space Odyssey, I believe you said, Richard. But anyways, I did it, one of my posters. And in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the proportions of the monolith are repeated over and over again in that movie, whether it be, you know, sort of little telescreens or certain panels in the walls. Like I saw this film review on it, and some people think that what Kubrick was trying to communicate, I would suggest he was in communication as well on this concept, if it's real, with Clark as well, but that the screen, the TV, this, you know, our phones, our video screens or whatever, is the way this information is going to be brought out.
And when Musk gets the Starlink system up and running, there won't be a Bushman or a Hottentot or a backwoodsman in Australia who doesn't instantly see the exact same lunar astonishing landscapes that we all do here in the so-called West.
Richard, I have a Facebook friend in the Gambia, you know, that little state, that little country on the west coast of Africa, beautiful. And he has a phone. That's how he communicates with me. He's got a little phone, right, that he's able to, you know, use. And when he goes to, he has to go to the internet cafe to do his, you know, his communications and, you know, that way. But the point is, this is a young Muslim man, a handsome guy, a great guy, big, big, huge family, beautiful beaches there in the Gambia. And he is going to get that information too, along with his village.
See, I worked with at Goddard with what was called the ATS project, where we were using a huge dish communication satellite called the Applications Technology Satellite, ATS, which I wrote a piece of basically attributing it to Arthur and his visions of satellite communications, which he loved. Arthur loved it when you mentioned him. Anyway, the idea was that we would have kids in India or in Africa on bicycles pedaling generators on bicycles to power the TVs that were receiving live information and television signals and programs from the ATS satellite that was being kind of breadboarded by NASA to see if this would work in out in the boonies. Now, of course, Musk is supplanting that primitive technology with something that every village can afford. You know, we got flat screens, we got little things like Ron is holding in his hand, mesmerized by the colors. So we've evolved to where the world is wired, humanity is about to be wired, so we can share our common, staggeringly different heritage of who we really are and share it with almost everybody on the planet simultaneously.
I agree.
Okay, you have some items to go through. We got 10 minutes till the top of the hour. Go.
Sure. Okay, so if you go to my items on the other side of where is it? I have to find it. Fast links to items. Go to me, Andrew. I got three posters. I've shown this in the past, but Richard wants me to summarize a little bit. So
yeah,
my
go,
number
go
one, I call it Reflection of a Lunar Dome. And I have some scans from your book, The Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. And Richard, why don't you do a quick synopsis of what this is? I have two images, one of Mitchell under the glass and then another one showing
Well, these are various images from NASA, which have been quietly supplanted by the, you know, they're supplanting the fake ones, but putting real ones in the archives. So when this all hits the rotating kitchen appliance and reporters, mainstream reporters like from the Times or the Washington Post or the Time Magazine or CNN start poking around, NASA can say, well, we never concealed anything. It's right there in the archive. And who, of course, are they going to believe? They're lion eyes or history. So on the left, Mitchell under glass is Edwin Mitchell, the astronaut on Apollo 14, who became a remote viewer, founded the extraordinary society there in California, looking into so-called paranormal stuff. The right-hand panel at the top is Schmidt, Dr. Schmidt, under glass at the Apollo 17 site. And, of course, the orange soil is the panel to the right. Below that is one of Bean's paintings showing the astronauts on Apollo 15 exploring the Hadley Rill. But the landscape is strangely colored, as is the one below it, because, of course, what Bean was doing was channeling the real moon, where the surface colors are coming from the refractions in the glass that I showed in some of my images, as opposed to the minerals of the surface, because the surface of the moon is pretty much gray unless you light it up with different kind of light from overhead from refractions in the dome.
Yep. And also the textures in the sky. His first paintings, when he sort of turned, you know, into the space artist, which was, he's been compared to the great Western artists, you know, of the great West, the United States.
Like Remington, for instance.
Like Remington, exactly. And a wonderful artist. But anyways, he had like the black sky, the sort of dull gray moonscapes, and he made this transition and he started to say, well, I'm just taking liberties, this is how I feel it is, you know, this is how I feel I want to see it.
Verily, like, Emily really, Dickinson, tell all the truth but tell it slant.
Yes. And you know, with the Mitchell under the glass, you know, we see these striations in the sky that you've brought out through enhancement, but there's these strange geometric patterns in it.
Oh, did I say that I scanned the original from Ken Johnston's stash,
right,
that he was at Houston in charge of photographs for the scientists, and he was ordered by his superiors at NASA at the Manned Spacecraft Center to destroy all but one copy of the Apollo films. And even though he was a young kid, like I was about the same age at CBS, he went, what? And he stole one set and took it home, sent another set to his alma mater, his university, and from his private stash, he then gave me 8x10 glossies that I scanned, and lo and behold, the NASA data that they've been looking at secretly and privately bears no resemblance to the fake data they've been putting out to the American taxpayer for half a century.
Yeah, and these textures in the sky is something that Bean just did it all the time. And I have my number six. This one's called "Our World at My Fingertips" from 2005. And he's putting his fingers, like he's imagining, so maybe he did this on the moon. He's imagining his fingers, you know, when you put your finger around the moon at night, or preferably not the sun, and you don't want to do that. But again, Richard, the sky is, or his background. I can know it's a painting, but it's revealing something deep, and he was just texturing the heck out of it. And remember how he described the actual black sky of the moon. Do you remember?
Well, of course.
Yeah, go ahead.
He described it as looking like black patent leather shoes.
Yeah.
And that went ding, 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 because black patent leather shoes are not velvet. They don't absorb all light. There's this subtle glistening. So when you look at the dark black sky of the vacuum of the moon, instead of seeing velvet where it absorbed all light, he saw it glistening like a dome of ancient eroded glass.
Yep.
So many clues. We have so much overwhelming evidence, and still people say we're nuts.
Well,
that's frustrating, Ron. That's what's frustrating.
Yeah, and we get it in the commercials. We get it in models, yeah. Model kits. I have in my number five, I call it Strange Skies. But in this model kit, this monogram model kit of the first lunar landing, and we went over this a few weeks ago, I think, I had a whole bunch of model kits that showed the same kind of sky. Instead of showing the sky, you know, the sky behind the moon is black with stars, this artist who was commissioned to do this piece is showing it with this weird, you know, haze and even structure. And my last image, I know we're coming close to the break here. This is something I did back in 2017. I did like a partial dome idea. And if you zoom in on it, whoops, I did zoom in on it and I zoomed it back out. I was trying to get the same kind of crisscross pattern. What I should probably do is cover the entire sky with this, Richard, in my illustration. But yeah, these are sort of my reflections on what I think we're seeing up there. And we don't have time to go to my next ones right now because I think we're coming up to the break.
We will do that after the break. And on cue, my guests this morning are too numerous to mention. That happens a lot on this show. It's really peculiar. So take a pause, take a break, go take a look at John's number 22. That is so amazing, so astonishing. And lend one ear to our promos, because to do all this work politically in the next few months, we need some infusion of listeners, subscribers to Club 19.5. We need some cash so you can donate, and we need a lot of help. And I'm going to tell you in the next hour how you can specifically help push this across the finish line. We're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter references by guest or subject. Membership cost $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. It's now Monday morning here in the Land of Enchantment. Welcome back, everyone. We got 1 hour to go. We're going to go after we finish through Andrew's materials, because he's got some pretty relevant things there, particularly in terms of one of those images, which I don't think is contemporary. And then we're going to bring on Robert Morningstar, who was our kind of civilian version of a CIA spook analyst, a guy who knows many different patterns and has many different secrets to reveal, probably not tonight, but at some future show. And then we're going to wind up with Ron, because Ron is going to take us from the moon to where in every NASA Artemis commercial or promo, they keep saying the Artemis generation is going to the moon because it's a stepping stone for the ultimate adventure beyond, which is to the planet Mars. So we're going to show you a few of the things on Mars, and then I'm going to give you all a mission, should you choose to accept it. So Andrew, please continue.
Thank you. Yeah, if we go to my number two under my items, this one is, I called it Clavius Crater, Ancient Evidence. And Richard, I'm going to let you take over just describing what these images are. I mean, the one on the left is obvious. That's a shot of the moon and Clavius Crater as we see it.
The image that both Robert and I independently discovered. He discovered it through, a Polish magazine, or reproduced in Time from a Polish magazine. And I found it on the NASA, astronomical image of the day site. They linked it to a website in Texas by an amateur astronomer who no more took this image than I did. And in fact, I call it the time capsule image because it shows the moon not as it appears now. I dare anybody to find anything in these images, of which we published slews of them over the last several months and years, to find anything even comparable on the contemporary moon, because we're looking at miles high skyscrapers. So I think this was a time capsule image that somehow fell into NASA's possession, and they put it out under a kind of a weird disclaimer, claiming some amateur in Texas took it, when 20 seconds of research shows you that's impossible. I think it was taken probably from an ancient archive that the Apollo astronauts found on the moon and brought home. And my likely suspect is so-called Data's Head, which was literally, if I'm right, brought home 50 years ago tonight by the crew of Apollo 17 to Houston, where they spent untold years and maybe decades figuring out how to talk to it, how to download its digital information. And then they published it in published media under the guise of an amateur contemporaneously photographing the moon from Texas. And that leads us to your number three, which is a stunning black and white version of number two above from the photograph, because we're literally looking at ancient sites on the moon like Clavius, where isn't it curious?
the clavius in this ancient image, if I'm right, is surrounded by towering tens of miles high skyscrapers, and it was Clavius where Arthur Clarke and Stanley Kubrick put their pivotal base in the 23rd century on, no, 21st century on
21st, yes.
The moon.
Yeah. No, this, again, my interpretation, Richard, but I'll tell you, in these spires from that, what you call an ancient archive, there are some shapes there.
Aren't there?
Yeah, that remind me of what we're seeing in the southern hemisphere of the moon that Keith Laney brought out. If we come out of that...
Except they're much bigger.
Yes,
it's
yeah.
It's like the
yeah,
ones that Laney found are much smaller, like human-scale versions of something much more ancient, because cultures borrow and borrow and borrow, and they hand down, and they hand down, and they hand down, and things get smaller when your technology is not up to the task to make it bigger.
Exactly. And so if we go to my number three real quick, and I've shown these images before, but it's worth coming back to. On the left-hand side, I scroll down, enlarging in DeForest, which is a lunar impact crater in the southern hemisphere. And one particular bone, the way I could describe it, like this wishbone
upside down
formation.
Wishbone. Yeah.
Yeah. I zoomed in as close as I could. And on the right side, as folks know, I've said this a million times, I did a little graphic short, which actually is an expanding story, which, by the way, I remember Robert had published it on his UFO Digest. Robert, thank you again for that. I'd forgotten about that. And in a couple weeks back, I did a drawing of as if, the astronauts are walking up to this thing. Again, it's from my imagination, but it doesn't take much to be able to extrapolate something out of these things. And as I'm saying, this sort of style, this architectural style is, I'm seeing it in those spires on Clavius. So there's a consistent, or at least a, like you say, Richard, a hand-me-down understanding. And I mean, it's all on the moon and that's all in the southern hemisphere. So when we do go there, I think you're right. I think we're going to find some stunning things, and it's going to be amazing.
How can we have all these people in Artemis or in Musk program or the collaboration, and we're not counting the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese. Chinese want to build a base, et cetera. How can we have all these people rushing around and not seeing what's really there? It's impossible. You can't suppress everybody, particularly in an era of social media and the gadget that Ron is staring longingly at right now. By his own admission. Okay, so are we done?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, on a table, I'm using a headset, but okay.
Super. Okay, so that's the perfect segue to Mr. Morningstar. First of all, big picture, what are your reaction to Artemis and what we found?
Hi, everybody. Good show. Very good show. My reaction is I'm very happy, elated, that Artemis worked and returned to Earth and that the hardware works. I'm disappointed with the video. I think NASA's messing around.
You think?
Again. No, you listed all of the same objections that I have about the video, and the one of the moon passing by the spacecraft I thought was just totally hokey. And the moon is out of focus. The spacecraft is in perfect focus right there in front of our faces, which we don't need to see. And in the background, as the moon is going by, it's out of focus. And also...
Now, you're talking about after they did the power burn and they were coming around the night side to make the final turn to Earth, right?
No, I'm talking about the video that you have on the site. Let me give you the number. It's the one where...
Well, this is 22. This is John's video, right?
I thought I saw it in your...
Well, I have a much the so-called Earth eclipse video.
You have the Earth eclipse. Okay, yes. I guess it is John's video.
Yeah, no, it's in John's video, and there's this huge curve, and you're crossing over Copernicus and Oceanus Procellarum, the Sea of Storms, and you're really close. And again, forget the details. That's not where the action is here. It's the color.
Yeah, the colors. The colors.
The
fine.
Colors are extraordinarily revealing, because that ain't the colors you get from geology and they move with the angle of the spacecraft, which is a dead giveaway. It's suspended above the surface in a glass-like set of layers.
Fine. Now let's go to my pictures.
Okay.
And my set of items for tonight's show. I find it very interesting that, hi, Jonathan, I enjoyed your presentation very much. I'm glad he was talking about telepathy, because I think that my section shows that all of us here are operating telepathically, though subconsciously or unconsciously. And Barbara brought up the subject of the NDAA and the provisions, whistleblower provisions, and just by chance, I chose an article.
No, it's not chance. Come on.
It's not chance. It's my brain. My brain is going around rummaging and looking for...
If this team is not in resonance by now,
right.
we should all quit unless the better guys get, you know, get on here.
Yeah. Is it interesting also the number on this, a preliminary look at the UAP-related provisions of the proposed FY 2023 National Defense Authorization Act, House Resolution 7776. Now, that's a really nice number.
Isn't it?
As far as I'm concerned. It's beautiful.
So many tetrahedral spins in that number.
Yeah, plus, if I recall correctly, the orbit of Mars is in there, too.
Yeah.
6 days. So anyway, the... not to waste a lot of time on this, Barbara covered it very well, but here's a secure method for authorized reporting, safe harbor, or UAP whistleblower provisions. And this interesting little group that they have, the All Domain Anomalies Resolution Office.
I love that name.
Arrow.
I love that name.
That's really cool. So let me go on. As far as the budget and spaceware is concerned, this week... the Defense Department, the Air Force, debuted the B-21 bomber. The B-2 Spirit has turned into the B-21, and they made their first public appearance. So I included two articles there. One was an article that was describing the coming debut, and then the actual release of the silhouette, the front view of the Raider. And
do you know offhand where it got that name?
I think it has, it's taking it from probably a World War II plane, Sky Raider.
No, you're very close. There's a public story and then there's a real story.
Mm-hmm.
The public cover story is they decided to name it after the Jimmy Doolittle raid on Tokyo from the Pacific back when, right after, Pearl Harbor, we wanted to strike back, so it's supposed to be the homage to Jimmy Doolittle's raid on Tokyo. I think it's more like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, of course, that can't escape us.
With all the sevens.
Yeah, it's very good. Excellent. So I found these two very important, and also the debut of the Raider at this time. Shows me that they're releasing peekaboo. They take a B-2 and turn it into a B-21. And I'd just like to refresh everyone's memories. We had 21 B-2 bombers. And from my spooky perch, I was able to find out that we have two kinds of B-2 and now B-21s. Of the 21 B-2 spirits that we had or have, 14 were conventional, and 7 have this high-tech ability to warp space-time and create gravity waves.
That's Paul LaViolette's electrogravitic version. Yeah.
Well, I learned about this in 1993.
So did he.
But I had to keep it secret. I came from a very close friend of mine in the United States Navy, and he explained to me how the advanced technology version of the Spirit energizes, electrifies the leading edge and the trailing edge of the wing. And this polarity creates a warping.
Which goes back to the Byfield Brown, T. Townsend Brown experiments.
Yeah. The other interesting thing they told me, or he told me, was that when the ship is in that gravity glide, that they actually drive electricity into the engines so that the engines are not just the regular propulsion, but there's kind of an electromagnetic propulsion.
Well, it's what's called a regenerative braking system. You're trading gravity for electrical energy, potential energy for, you know, electrical storage.
Yeah. Now we come to the good stuff. Here's the other telepathic part. Richard and I haven't spoken in days, and both of us today pulled out pictures by Andrew McCarthy. Andrew McCarthy, he's a very, very talented astronomer and an excellent photographer. So I thought I'd give you all a treat and give you two color pictures of the moon so that we could compare. So if you click Andrew McCarthy's Twitter page, you get a glorious, overly saturated color picture of the moon, which intrigues me, though, since we found those, the original true colors of the moon, as you related a couple of years ago, the true colors of the moon are revealing the formation of the moon. It's pretty clear to me. So I'd just like to say that I believe that the Mare Tranquillitatis was created by a huge meteor or asteroid impact, and that the ejecta that was thrown out revealed that orange color that you, very, Andrew put it out. He inserted a picture of the orange soil that was discovered in Shorty Crater, bright, brilliant orange. So I think that's one of the substrates of the moon. And when this asteroid collided and created this incredible chasm, which is the Mare Tranquillitatis, the ejecta headed to what we would call the northwest and piled itself on the Mare Serenitatis. So when you compare in this Andrew McCarthy picture, all of the rust, look at all the rust color in the Mare Sea of Serenity, Mare Serenitatis, and even spilled over into the northern regions and over all the way over to the crater Plato in the Oceanus Procellarum. So it's wonderful stuff for me.
Well, the main difference between the colors on the near side, which is what we're looking at in Robert's second item, where it says true colors of the moon, and the colors that that John has brought out in the video of the far side, are that the colors on the far side are the glass, because it's much thicker, it's less damaged, it's less, you know, eroded, shattered, abraded, etc. The glass of the dome on the near side is almost gone. I keep telling people it's the consistency of cigarette smoke, which is why the Apollo crews and the unmanned spacecraft, except in certain weird instances, can safely land through it, because it's almost not there. It's like cigarette smoke, you know, floating in the wind. The colors you're seeing on the near side are the geology of the moon's surface, the ground, the mineralization, the doping with metals and, you know, titaniums and other elements that we're familiar with on Earth, because they upwelled as volcanic upwellings after these huge impacts that created those basins that, frankly, I think were directed strikes to eliminate the huge cities that used to be in those basins. I mean, we're talking about a war, a huge interplanetary war in this model that resulted in half the moon being essentially destroyed, and the other half might as well be, except the glass shell covering the other side is pretty much like it used to be. So we see it in these extraordinary prismatic colors. They're not the same as the colors on the front.
Right. Could the glass
Could the glass be interdimensional? Ingo was looking into another dimension when he's viewing the moon, and I wonder if the glass has some sort of interdimensional property.
Well, given that in that Chinese image, which shows that there's an upper layer that's absorbing, you know, which is interchanging energy with the sun and absorbing it. As I said to Ron the other night when I looked at one of these images, I think this might be smart glass, meaning that it's not just, you know, like an inverted salad bowl. It's got active properties, It's intelligent. It stores energy. It runs electricity. It filters electromagnetism. It may actually have a hyperdimensional torsion component. In other words, it's not dumb architecture. It's smart architecture. And so all bets are off.
Yeah. I wanted to mention to Jonathan, I'm glad that you brought up Ingo Swann. I met Ingo Swann here in New York as well. I've read his book, Penetration. I've also been teaching remote viewing courses, month-long courses over the last few months. I'll be starting another one at the end of this month, probably around the 22nd, if anyone is interested. But here's another...
Wait, how can they sign up?
Oh, they contact me through Robert Morningstar at proton.me. Robert Morningstar at proton.me. I worked for years to find the easiest email to remember. And if you know an Adam, you know Proton, and you know me, it's easy to remember. Robert Morningstar at proton.me. So send me a note that you're interested in the remote viewing course. But what I want to say, very important. I also know Russell Targ, and I had the privilege earlier this year of having a private conversation on Zoom with Russell and Jack Sarfati. And Russell brought up the subject that Jonathan brought up, the remote viewing of Jupiter by Ingo Swann, and telling NASA, hey, you know, Jupiter has rings. Like, no, you're crazy. No, that's New Jupiter. It has rings, and he drew them. I have never seen the diagram. Thank you, Jonathan, for providing that diagram that Ingo wrote or drew. But here's the important thing for me that really floored me. Russell Targ said that remote viewing operates faster than the speed of light. And the proof that he offered was that he was there in the room when this happened. And he said that Ingo Swann went into his mediumship or his trance or his remote viewing in 30 seconds to 1 minute. And he was there in Jupiter. He was there orbiting Jupiter and looking at the rings. And as we know, it takes 54 minutes for light from Jupiter to arrive at Earth. It takes 8 minutes for the light from the sun to arrive here, but Jupiter is so much farther. It takes 54 minutes. But that statement by Russell Targ really floored me. Ingo Swann's remote viewing skills operated faster than the speed of light.
If they're hyperdimensional, of course they would.
Speed of thought. Yeah, they're not part of the clock.
They're not in this dimension.
Absolutely
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Okay. So we're all
so
in
we're
agreement.
Not limited.
Right.
So Einstein is wrong. Einstein.
I describe it in one of my novels. Sorry, Robert, but I describe it in one of my novels, where Jack Ramsey finds himself out of his body and he's flying around the Earth and space. He understands that flying at the speed of thought makes the unbreakable speed limit of the universe, put forth by Einstein, seem like a broken down Model T Ford, where he's driving a sleeked-up Maserati, the speed of thoughts.
I'm sorry, John. I think that's completely wrong.
Well, we didn't ask that. We're still on this subject of these pictures. But I wanted to thank you for that. It brings back really good memories. And the book Penetration is fantastic. In my courses, which I began teaching about 5 years ago at the Edgar Cayce Center in New York, they were a month long. And on the last night, we would go to the moon, where I would teach the training methods and the breathing techniques. And on the last night, we would venture to the moon. And my students saw the bridges that Ingo Swann saw. Another student found herself in an underground cavernous factory. She said that it was full of aliens. They were just going about their business. They were very robotic, very mechanical. They were packing stuff and moving stuff and just totally oblivious of her presence there. But the gentleman who really stunned me was a man who came in on the very last night of the webinar, or the seminar in those days. And he said, I'm sorry, I couldn't take the course. I've just gotten to New York, but I'd like to take the class. So he took the class. And we went through the meditation. When he came back, he said something amazing. He said, you know, I think there's something wrong. I don't know. I went into a cavern, but I couldn't believe what I was smelling. And I said, what? He says, I'm a spelunker. I'm a cave diver. And what I found, I was in a cavern and it was full of wet rocks. And we know that there's no water on the moon. And I said to him, wrong. I just published an article.
What year was this? What year?
This was 2016, 2017.
Oh, yeah. He obviously didn't hear the word. Yeah.
I had published the University of Tennessee's monograph, Water is Ubiquitous on the Moon. And they came to that conclusion from studying the contents of the lunar rocks that were brought back by Edgar Mitchell. And they concluded that there was so much limestone, which can only be formed in water. There's so much limestone in the samples he brought that the moon had to be full of water at one time. And of course, my theory is that a lot of the water is underground. So this spelunker from Colorado did the meditation and found himself in a lunar cave smelling wet rocks.
Wow.
That was very impressive.
That's a multi-sensory immersive experience.
Yes, you know, this one thing is remote viewing has so many levels that everybody's thinking about the vision part, the seeing part. But remote viewing involves every sense, including eyesight, hearing.
Yeah, but smell is so much part of outer body and hypnotic regression and even ghostly spirit apparitions. You know, you smell.
Exactly.
I swear I've smelled Robin's perfume so strong at sometimes that, mm-hmm. you know, she's there behind the glass somewhere.
Well, Raymond Lanzett has the same experience in The Young Invited, remember?
Yes.
The smell of mimosa?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, the good ghost and the vengeful ghost. So let's go on. And,
by the way, Robert,
yeah.
Sorry, I can interrupt. Folks, what Robert talks about is really real, and we have a real-world example. I won't get into it deeply, but basically, Robert, last week, tapped into my youngest son's dream, and in a separate email, highlighted everything that my son told me about this nightmare he was having. This is real stuff, folks. It's real.
Yeah. Well, Andrew and his family are very dear to me. We are family, and Stellan is a very dear person in my life. So I was told that he was having trouble, and he went to a camp of some sort, Native American camp. You call them what, First Nations. And the second day he got sick and he wasn't feeling well. And Andrew and I talked and he said, he's been away from home a lot. Maybe just needs to stay away. And he said to me, would you try to send him some good dreams and so he can get through this thing? So I went to sleep and I said, yeah, you know what? I love Stellan. I'm going to send him some good dreams and I'm going to concentrate on him tonight. And what happened was I had the most dreadful night imaginable. I had very little sleep because I found myself completely isolated in a huge, huge room that had several beds that looked like bunks and nobody around and totally isolated and a sense of strangeness and possibly menace. You know, roaming the atmosphere, totally alone.
Remember, there are two sides to Revelation.
Yeah.
The good side and the guys that don't want us ever to remember.
That's right.
You're on the other side of midnight. We'll be back for our last half hour. Ron will take center stage and will take us to some extraordinary things on Mars because, like my grandmother used to say about the quilt, if you pull on the right thread, the whole damn thing is going to fall apart. That's what's going to happen with the cover-up. Fasten your seatbelts. The future has arrived.
We are your friends.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. The planet's very bright, extraordinary for us.
And welcome back. Last half hour to go on this Sunday night, Monday morning edition of The Other Side of Midnight. We've been to the moon. Every time NASA mentions Artemis, inevitably, and originally I thought it was kind of like because, you know, Donald Trump, because he's the guy that kind of accelerated us getting back to the moon by 2024. It's probably going to be 2025 now. But he kind of complained at one point to Bridenstine, who he'd appointed as the NASA administrator, hey, you guys keep talking about the moon, but you never talk about Mars. So from then on, even through the change of administration, every time NASA mentions Artemis, every time it talks about return to the moon, this time to stay, and the Artemis generation, they bring up Mars. So they are cementing in the public mind Moon, Mars, Moon, Mars. And when there are discovered to be ET ruins on the moon, by metonymy, they will also extend in the public mind to Mars. So, Ron, that is your cue. Take it away.
Am I muted?
Who? What? Someone's here? Muted, but you're not.
Richard, I wanted to finish the two pictures that I have left over. They are important. There's
okay.
One good black and white photo that came from the Orion camera.
Oh, these horrible pictures. They're terrible.
I downloaded it, and I isolated one section, which has some very interesting rectangular.
Oh, there's stunning stuff all over the place, but they're horrible pictures.
Well, I isolated it. I made it smaller, and I put letters so that you can all explore it. And the last thing I wanted to say was with regard to Stellan's experience. When I had that remote viewing experience of being in his place, I wrote to Andrew right away that he should go and pick him up and bring him home. And he wrote back, we're already on our way because he's not feeling well. So that's it, and I'm looking forward to hearing Ron.
Ron, that's your cue.
Oh, you sure? Nobody else? Okay. I think you go through this, including playing that Carpenter song, just to get me grumpy. I'm at my best when I'm grumpy, but I should say you wouldn't like me when I'm grumpy. Okay, I'm trying to figure out which pictures are the important couple that I can do. But people can just look at my offerings there. And number 7, I was sure to remember that, should have a sort of a sawtooth appearance in the top panel.
Yeah, that thing in the middle of the crater. It's not really
a
crater.
No. All three panels are the same, from the same image. It's one of the Artemis images. And at the top, as part of the manifestations of enhancement, I looked at the separate channels, the alphas, as the Adobe people call them, and the saturation channel is a very good place to see if somebody had messed with the image, you know, before I got it. And So what you see there, that ragged, sawtooth, very artificial-looking stuff in the sky.
You mean number four?
Is it number four now?
Number four, yes, number four.
I absolutely checked it. I put it in as number one. I checked it with Keith this afternoon, and it was number four. And
it's number four.
Or number seven. Now he couldn't find it.
It's number four.
But it's there. As long as it's there. That one with the big black jagged area at the top. I got to do this or I'll never get through it. That is the result of some NASA tech masking out the sky so that you couldn't see anything but right on the edge of the limb.
Yeah, they're cutting out the dome, obviously.
Right, but the odd one about this one was, do you notice the blurriness on the left side of the teeth? I mean, the teeth on to the left side there?
Yep, yep.
It was like second thought. I don't know what order the messing was done. I mean, it's not unusual or unorthodox for astronomers to mat out the sky around something they've taken a picture of because they got a whole bunch of big blank space that doesn't really show anything around their little meteorite or whatever they're taking a picture of. And so that's often done just to you know.
Except you can see the detail they left sticking up between the jaggies and behind them. It's like they did a really, really, really crappy rush job, or the good guys performed to the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law.
Yeah, I've never seen one that was messy like this. I've seen various, obviously various hands at work, like the hand of a telegrapher. You can tell if it's a different graphics person working.
I think you can see the top of the dome there sticking up between the jaggies.
That could be what that is. Yeah, very much so.
Well, it doesn't match the jaggies, which are how they're obscuring.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. I think you're seeing what's left of the dome in this. See, this was a super close up with a super good camera. The nav cam. Why is it super good?
Yeah,
because the astronauts will depend on it with their literal lives if they lose communication with Houston, which they did twice during this mission. Go ahead.
Let me run through the rest of them. Give me something here. There's two of the images. I have to do it this way because obviously somehow the numbers got scrambled. It wasn't Keith's fault. One says Apollo Orbital and the other says Lunar Orbital 2. The Lunar Orbital 2, that's just to show, I just thought for comparison's sake, you could see what kind of pictures they used to take.
Lunar Orbital 2 is number one. Apollo Orbital Combo is number two.
Yeah, well, they're labeled, so it doesn't matter. But on the Lunar Orbiter one, you'll notice that's the entire film frame. They were taking pictures on film and sending them back. So I included that with the little, the edges to it and so forth, and that's a blow-up of it. And it's not great, but you can see there's ruins there. The other one, the Apollo Orbital one, with apologies to, I think it was Dave Serrato that was credited with this, yes, you can get color out of a black and white image, and it's not phony. On the left is one. Both images were taken from Apollo as it looped around the moon on different missions. They happen to go over the same spot, more or less. And I actually found that, realized that it was almost exactly the same spot accidentally when I was putting them together, but because I did them at separate times. But the one on the left, that's colorized by me using not paint. It's just I brought it out from the black and white. So it does add detail. Make up your own mind. But that's what those looked like. And then the freestanding one, don't know how to describe it because I don't know which one it is, but it's an Artemis picture, obviously. And it's if you look closely in those craters, these have rather pronounced white rings around them. It's almost like looking at a fried egg from a distance. And surprise, that white stuff is not all sticking up. You'll see that on some of the others where I brought out as much of it as I could, but it's flat. These are pieces of something that are super reflective, like so much else we've seen on Mars and the moon. And inside one of them is something that looks kind of like one of those things you use to pull the cork out of a wine bottle, except for the fact that it's several blocks long. So it's a piece of the old machinery or something. And finally, in terms of those, there's one from Apollo 15 that's the Mare Smithii area that we dealt with before. But just that's, you know, that's a good picture taken by astronauts, and unlike what we got out of Artemis
on film. And, yeah, good old film.
Yeah, and the last, yeah, the last two color ones are just head scratchers. The one from Perseverance starts with a ZRF.
It's number 8.
Yeah, is well, everybody's seen that. That was on day number 4, sol number 4 for Perseverance, and those are all, you know, those are all from there. But the upper right there is with a bit of time applied to it. I was able to get rid of all of the phony shadow covering that end of it. And you can see why they were so interested. It's got all a whole bunch of sculptures there. And the other one is just a complete, oh, good, now I have time for comments.
Looks like Arches Park.
Huh?
It's the same people that made Arches Park.
Oh, maybe, maybe
oh,
not.
You mean the moon arch? You mean the moon arch?
No, 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 no. He's talking about Utah, and was it Kodiak Butte?
Yeah, and
Temple was we called it.
Yeah, that's what NASA named it, Kodiak. So it's which means bear. So it's in Inuit. Anyway, the remaining one, the bluish one, the oblong one.
Number 9 says Spirit.
That was from Spirit. That picture was done 20 years ago, and that's one of their triplets, which I always search out, which means that they didn't have color cameras on Spirit or Opportunity, and so they had to take 3 shots, but since it wasn't rolling anywhere, it was
through red,
there,
green, and blue filters, yeah.
Exactly. And there's several of them. I've showed one before and made people go, what the hell is that? Well, I don't know. But this is another one. It's exactly the same, except the color's better. You can see there's like a brass ring that's like, it looks like a very earth-like plumbing part, a vent or a drain or something. This one, it has to be on a sort of a vertical surface. This is not the same one as the I was trotting around before. And that cluster of little holes up to above it to the left, I think we were supposed to think that this was the result of some piece of hardware on Spirit, like a brush or a drill.
The rat.
It's not. Huh?
The rat.
Yeah. And it's not. The size is wrong. It doesn't match the other one. It can't possibly be the same thing. Plus, if you look at it, you'll see that what it punched, what it's a hole through. I won't say punched through because it looks like it was punched out by a hole punch, not drilled out. There's something behind there, and it's a relatively thin, apparently translucent surface there that we're thinking of, you know, looks like a glacier or a rock, because you'll see wires sticking out and things. It's a mystery item that they looked at, and both Spirit and Opportunity took pictures of these things, and they were in very different parts of the planet, but I guess they only shared a few of them. So that's, you know, that, and the rest of the pictures just, you know, you can, if you puzzle it out, you can see that, yes, there's buildings there, if anybody still thinks that the moon doesn't have structures on it. See that.
Ron, what do you think created the soot around the lower circle?
I think that when that there was under some pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very, you're right. That's very similar to what shows on the other one. I think that you see that little scratch in the very middle of the red part in between,
yes,
inside the ring. And by the way, I think it's blurry because they were kind of leaning over. That was as close as they could get with that camera. Because you see on the inner surface of the brass part, there's a red reflection, which would be the sun seen from Mars. But you see that little scratch in there? I think it vented. And they don't necessarily post stuff in order. Oh, this does have the stuff at the bottom. And you can see there's some kind of business that was just starting to look interesting right at the bottom edge. But that is the edge.
Well,
of the
if you encounter a mechanical container on Mars and you punch through it with a drill, the stuff inside, if it's pressurized, is going to get escape, and the atmosphere is at least a tenth of the Earth, maybe smaller, so you're going to get, you know, spray.
Yeah, they just discovered some brass containers in Syria that are 4,000 years old, and the liquid is still, well, not exactly fresh, but there's inside of them because... Yeah, people have eaten mastodon steaks and all kinds of things.
Okay,
on archaeological digs are crazy. Yes.
We need to talk about the mission.
Okay.
I want to commission all our audience tonight, every person listening anywhere in the world, you can all participate because there are translators. You don't need to know English. I want you to go to items 3 and 4 in my section, which are the backgrounds of the 8 civilians that Musk and company have picked to be part of the first civilian non-government crew orbiting the moon, maybe as early as next year, maybe a year from this December, depending upon how the test with the Starship go. I want you to note their names, read their backgrounds. That's why I gave you 2 sources, 2 different news agencies. They both overlap. You're then going to go and find these people on social media. You're going to track them down, Twitter, Facebook, any of the other social media, the new ones that are coming up in the face of what Elon Musk is doing with Twitter.
You're talking about the group that Musk...
The group that's going to the moon. 8 people.
Including the girl that doesn't like fracking. There's pictures. Yeah,
but there's people. Also names and bios, and you can track them down through social media because they're suddenly superstars. They're going to be very visible.
Argument. I just wanted to make sure. Yeah, no argument.
Who else would I be talking about? The janitors? The SpaceX?
Bezos has his own group of...
This is Musk. This
people.
Is SpaceX. This is...
Yeah.
The moon mission, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you're going to track these people down and start sending them email and commenting on their posts. If they have Facebook pages or they have Twitter accounts, you're including Musk, and you're going to point them all to all of the lunar shows that the other side of midnight has done. If you're really enterprising, enterprising, you will send them links to those shows. You will inveigle them to listen. You will send them images from those shows. You will tell them each they can become the chief architects of the future of humankind, and all they have to do is keep their eyes open, their cameras ready, and their microphones hot to describe what they see as they curve around the moon and see what human eyes have not seen since the Apollo program and what uncensored human eyes have not seen for maybe several tens of thousands of years. That is your mission, should you choose to accept it. The floor is open.
Okay, good. Good suggestion. A thought comes to mind. Private individuals have gone up into space before.
Dennis Tito spent $20 million to spend 2 weeks in the Russian segment of the International Space Station, or maybe it was Mir. He didn't see anything because he was in low Earth orbit.
Yeah. Did he say anything about it afterward?
He was in low Earth orbit. The Earth is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Period.
So he was on the threshold of anywhere is Heinlein.
Yeah, but you have to physically get there. Going to the moon, like Musk is going to do, by taking 8
Fair
civilians,
enough.
Artists, with cameras and all kinds of social media. They will be sending extraordinary pictures compared to NASA's crap.
You know, when you and Andrew were discussing the astronaut painting, it occurred to me,
Alan Bean.
Alan Bean. Okay, thank you. I know the names of most of them. I just didn't want to get the wrong one there with that. But who? You know what else causes colored lights to be visible on the ground. Remember the way that the some of the early Perseverance pictures had those refractive lights, mostly green, but some red and blue, on the ground, and we figured out it had to be from glass?
Yeah, it was the sun shining through the glass that's remaining in the dome over Jezero, imaging on the ground just like a lens.
Right. Now then, what happens in a classic church? They have stained glass windows. Why do they have stained glass windows? Because they cast all these lovely colors on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of bathe everybody in them. And I think that memory of a church is the link that allowed at least some of the astronauts to remember the colors they saw. Because it is fleeting. You know, you're not looking up and seeing something that looks like carnival glass at all times. Mm. You know, it's
Andrew, you're the art therapist. What do you think?
Well, the only thing I'd say, I mean, I don't disagree with Ron, but was it Madrid?
Yeah, the Crystal Palace in Madrid.
Yeah, was that color glass or was that just the
light? No, it's transparent, refractive, prismatic edges and geometry doing all that extraordinary color work, including, which is crucial to the understanding the moon, the pastels. Because what I didn't put up was a slide showing when you take a prism and you take two prisms and you cross the streams, Ghostbusters here, you cross the prismatic colors from the prisms, where you cross them, you get all the colors of the glass on the moon. And you see that in that enlarged inset that I did in that one comparison in my section tonight.
If I had to speculate, I would say that what you're saying, Richard, they knew the secondary effects that it would cast these colors.
Of course.
Probably within their world and just would change depending on what was the time of the day.
What I've done is I've taken that picture of the so-called orange soil that Robert posted.
Yeah.
And I basically just, resaturated the color of the rest of the frame. And it's incredibly colorful because of the light shining at low sun angle through the glass dome over Taurus Littro. In fact, that's the interesting thing about that frame. The orange glass, which is bubbling up from deep under the moon, under layers, like Robert said, that's kind of normal geology. The really amazing part is that image is so colorful, taken on very slow color film, when you put the color back in that's there that NASA suppressed in the lab in Houston under the aegis of a guy named Dick Underwood, who was the chief photographer for the Apollo program at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
Definitely somebody's doing that job now because they just drained all the color out of those Artemis pictures.
And it's funny.
Go ahead.
Well, you should mention pastels. I didn't include it today, but I've shown it back in 2015. I can't believe I've been doing this long. Anyway,
see how time flies when you're having fun making history.
I know. Well, there's a painting he did, and he calls it Monet's Moon, and it's gorgeous. It's just it looks like these. Yours and Robert's images of the real color, or Andrew McCarthy, the fellow that you guys had, and it looks just like that. It looks like this, as if Monet had transported himself out into space and was like painting watercolor.
Well, you understand that those colors are incredibly subtle. Those are enhancements out of the background, but they're there. They're real color.
Yeah.
They're real mineral colors. The colors on the far side, and that incredible video sequence that John did as they were crossing Procellarum in the spacecraft, before they go behind the curve, that you can clearly see is the near side because of the mare, the smooth mare. That color is the glass still remaining over the near side. And because there's so much of it, if you look through enough hundreds of miles of even incredibly eroded glass, you'll see enough to see that there's something there. And that's what we're seeing on the near side.
And if I can throw something in there.
By all means.
It's Arches Park again, because I'm studying how they're dividing up the frequencies of visible light
for different purposes, among them healing, spiritual, you know, heightened consciousness, these kind of things. And it just reminds me of what we're seeing on the moon.
Well, look,
that reminds you.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was just, I did have a thought on those bridges, those interrupted bridges seen, and because they were even referenced by George Leonard, the one that wrote that.
Yes.
Somebody else is on the moon.
Yeah.
Book. And parenthetically about that, by the way, I've owned copies of both the hardbound one and the much more easily available paperback edition that came out later.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? The pictures are better quality in the paperback
of
than
course.
They are in the original one. Yeah, they really must them up. Even though most people can't see much in most of them, they're frustrating as hell. But he had an effect on me, as Richard knows. We talked about it many, many years ago. But the those bridges, they're like a tuning fork.
You mean like the
There's
stuff in the
things.
Center of the Göbekli Tepe site?
And that one's not coming to mind, but yeah, they were there for some mechanical purpose like that. There's only three things they could be, as far as I could see. Either because I don't think that they just stopped working on them at a certain point, you know, because the senator's committee funds ran out or something. They either they were vertical and therefore part of the dome structure, and they just fell over. And the stuff is so, the material is so sturdy, the ribbing anyway, you know, any framing that it has, that it's still there. Or they were launching tracks, you know, the other way to launch a rocket where you magnetically propel it along a track that's pointed vaguely upwards. Or they were some sort of resonant.
Yeah, we have 30
tool.
Seconds till we run out of runway.
Well, that's good. Yeah. and launch into orbit, let's hope.
Yeah.
Hey, Richard, really
anyway.
Quick, Georgia Lambert sends something. I'm going to read the title, Inadvertent Nanotechnology, Purified Air in Medieval Churches. I'm going to read you one sentence. Put more simply, the gold used to decorate medieval era stained glass windows purifies the air when sunlight shines through the windows.
Oh, what
very
a marvelous
nice.
Idea.
Good one, Georgia.
Hey, guys, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank all my guests in numerous dimensions. Go to the website and you'll see all their names and all their contributions. And Cynthia was here in spirit. She was actually here physically. But I don't think she, I think she's still thinking about what we're seeing on the moon. Next weekend, I have no idea what we're doing. How's that for an admission? But we'll do something. So until then, same time, same bat channel. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everybody, and go Artemis!